Okay. Tokyo.
South America.
Go head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Here we go. We are off and running on this, the 8th day of June, 2018. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where we live. That's where you go if you'd like to be part of the madcap, multimedia, merry, wacky, zany, real-time extravaganza that is The Horn chat room. Pick yourself out a screen name and a password and jump right in where you will be welcomed and greeted and met by the likes of Anatole and Little Thunder and Malin and Squeaky and VT Vlom and others who will wander along during the course of the program, capably moderated by longtime, inveterate, indefatigable chat room moderator Sparky, who, although a spacing guild master, finds it a mite hot for folding space into the man cave this evening. You'll also be capably moderated by occasional wandering in chat room moderator Asa. So it's a rare triple moderation treat tonight in the Horn chat room, and maybe even midweek pinch hit utility chat room moderator Steve, and all around great guy Steve from Georgistan will walk in, and we will then be moderator poor. Yes. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, for letting me know that Friday on the Front Porch is hot on both platforms. Thank you. So we're streaming merrily along via both White Rose and HeadOn.live. Thank you very, very much indeed. Like I said, it's the 8th day of June. We are at the end of the first full week of June. And we come to the end of the first full week of June needing to raise $440 to finish the broadcast week and move boldly into the second full week of June. Yes. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. I don't know if I did. I forget about that. It's easy. And we will do the Friday on the Front Porch Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable here in about 55 minutes or so. And, of course, the same rules apply. If you would like to participate, well, the only way to do that is through Skype, and you need to send a contact request on Skype, if you've never done so before. You need to send a contact request on Skype to Sparky Dunk, SparkyDunk, Sparky Dunk, one word, and Sparky will then show you the breadcrumb trail that will lead you to the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable. And we have a heck of a good time every evening. Thanks go out, as they always do at the beginning of the program, to subscribers who help keep the program on the air. We knock down about a week's worth of broadcasting thanks to our subscribers. Someday maybe we'll knock down the whole month, and I won't talk about fundraising anymore. And what a glorious day that will be. But thanks go out to Nancy in Virginia. Thank you, Nancy, so very much. Thank you to Dwayne in PA. Thank you, Dwayne. Thanks to Tom in PA. Thank you very kindly to Tom. And thank you to Marcia in Oregon. Thank you, Marcia, very, very much indeed, as well as to Ron in the far frozen north. Yes. And I'm proud to say that the last of the challenges were met last night. So that's always nice to see when people step forward with exhortations to double the money of other contributors. Thank you very much, one and all. And again, a special happy birthday wish going out to our buddy Glenn in New York, tomorrow being his. Happy birthday, Glenn. So, yeah, there we are. And, of course, the general, the usual, the if you want to help keep the program on the air, by golly, the way you do that is over at headon.live. There's a button there for PayPal if you want to become a subscriber or you just want to help out, you know, at this point in time. And there's a button for Patreon if you hate PayPal and you would like to just set it and forget it and carry through, have everything just happen on the first day of the month. Okay? So that's where all of that stands. Wow. Thank you. Darlene in Connecticut, subject line, $100 challenge in memory of Anthony Bourdain. Thank you. That is... that's sweet, Darlene. So that would go along. That would knock down almost half of what we've got to go this evening. Thank you, Darlene, very much indeed. Because I have a feeling Darlene knows that that's been much on my mind all day. It was the first thing I saw this morning. And for those of you who don't know, world traveler, I would even call him a documentarian. He probably would have bristled a bit at the idea of being called a journalist, but in fact, he was probably a better journalist than 90% of the people at CNN. Former executive chef and worker in the culinary trenches of New York City, Anthony Bourdain, was found dead earlier today at the age of 61. By what appears to have been his own hand, by suicide. And I won't lie. It's touched me deeply. I didn't know the man. I was privileged to carry on two conversations with him. The last one about 8 years ago. And it can't help but when somebody you respect and who is very much in the public eye passes away, especially under circumstances such as these, it cannot help but engender the reflective impulse in us. You know, every evening when I close the program, I thank you all for sharing your precious, finite time on this planet with me and with each other, because it is, in fact, the most precious resource you have. And to share it, much as Bourdain learned with traveling and sharing food with people, is to share the essence of what we are with each other. And, you know, there was Bourdain in our homes, week in and week out, taking most of us to places most of us will never see, and giving us a view of the place that was far more nuanced and far more substantive than most any travel log. He eschewed the typical kitsch and the ordinary tourist traps and the things that most usually appeal to tourists, and instead looked for the things that made the places unique within the human experience. And it tore me up this morning. Because it reminded me of the fragility of human life. And moreover, well, it sort of connected me to what to some essential human truths. I thought immediately, for instance, of John Donne and his poem, No Man is an Island. No man is an island entire of itself. Each is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of thine own or of thine friends were. Each man's death diminishes me, for I am involved in mankind. Therefore send not to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. It didn't start out as a poem. It started out as a meditation. And a meditation it is indeed, and has served the test of time. And I'll say this, and I hope it will not prove offensive. But one of the things, and especially in conjunction with the recent suicide of handbag designer Kate Spade, who in her own way brought a great deal of joy into people's lives, coming in such short order. Well, in both instances, the stories were accompanied by, if you're contemplating suicide or you're thinking about suicide, please call the suicide hotline. Help is available. And in fact, Ivanka Trump, even on the heels of proving her fecklessness with her picture of her and her baby, while other babies were being ripped from other mothers' arms, well, she tweeted about that too. Apparently, it's congenital, that tweeting stupidity thing in that family. Talking about how anybody can get help. Well, it's not true. This is not that country. I had a press release today from the fine, I use the term sarcastically, people at Americans for Limited Government. Sessions boldly upholds Roberts' Obamacare decision by not defending unconstitutional of an individual mandate. Yeah, that's real bold there, Jefferson Davis Beauregard Sessions III. That's real bold indeed, not defending the one thing that sort of props up the entire Affordable Care Act so that more people have access to health care. Bold, by God, that's bold. And we certainly learn a little bit about the morals of the people at Americans for Limited Government in saying, Attorney General Jeff Sessions took an extremely bold step in deciding not to defend what remains of the Obamacare law. When Congress eliminated the individual mandate tax penalty by zeroing it out, the tax of which was cited as the primary rationale of the constitutionality of Obamacare by Chief Justice John Roberts in his majority opinion, the fundamental constitutional underpinning of the law was removed. In doing so, Congress effectively ended the constitutional rationalization for the law, and Attorney General Sessions is correct in stating that the Justice Department will not defend a law that the Supreme Court has already said is not constitutionally sound on Commerce Clause grounds. Screw all you people! You don't need health care. Or access to it. No matter why. And so we see the moral fiber of the American political right. And it is not a pretty picture. And it leads to real tragedy and real horror. And that's the America we live in. I wish it wasn't, but it is. To get back to the topic at hand, I'm diminished in my own way by the passing of Anthony Bourdain. As we move on now, it will be noted that one of his final shows in his final season at CNN was one that was shot here in West Virginia. in which he saw, well, folks that he didn't necessarily agree with, broke bread with them, talked with them, and saw the up close and personal the horrors of the opioid epidemic as it affects Appalachia, and knew the horrors of opioids in his own right. And took the matter significantly to heart. In the last year or so, he also became, to his credit, an outspoken supporter of women who, in their various industries, have been subjected to horrifying sexual abuse and sexual assault. He was led to that by the woman that he was seeing even at the time of his death, Asia Argento, an Italian actress and director. And even meditated on why, through his career, he had not been the kind of person that women felt like they could trust to tell what was happening to them. We do not know what motivates people to decide to check out on their own terms. But there is one thing, and I was leading to it when I mentioned that the stories, both obituaries, both announcements, contain paragraphs about the suicide hotline, and that was beneficial. But I think we might make more progress in understanding what moves people to do that if we would stop simply defaulting to the idea that it is an act driven by mental illness. Because it's out there now. It was a matter both of it was included in the speculation regarding the death of Kate Spade, and now it's included in the speculation regarding the death of Anthony Bourdain. That, well, goodness me, they must have been crazy in order for them to decide that it was just time to go. And that's one of those things that's so embedded in our culture that we take it as gospel, even though there's not necessarily any data to support it. We've only got meaningful treatment for mental illness in the last 75 years or so, tops. Before then, the horrors are simply unspeakable. And there are no enlightened cultures in regard to mental illness. But even now, we make assumptions about mental illness that are not necessarily valid. When a school gets shot up, well, by Jiminy, right there on the spot is the National Rifle Association, ready to declare, in order to protect their wallets and their bank accounts and their access to power and money, ready to declare that, well, you know, and we, you know, we saw it after Santa Fe in Texas. That godforsaken, not a felon by the grace of, not God, but the courts, Ollie North saying, it's because all these boys are on Ritalin. Well, Ritalin's a treatment for attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder. And it's a treatment that works. And there was not a shred of data to suggest that what he was saying was true. But by God, rather than deal with the problem with guns in this country, there was Ollie North hooting about the crazy kids taking all that there Ritalin. And it wasn't an isolated event. After the slaughter at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, there was a national orgy of talking about mentally ill people getting guns. And there is the assumption that anybody who would shoot up a school is crazy, and it is simply not true. People often act out of semi-rational motives that result in irrational ends. But that is not the definition nor the pathology of a mental illness. And so it is patently unfair to always assume that someone who kills him or herself is crazy. We do not know what the motive. We do not know for sure what the motivations behind Ms. Spade or Mr. Bourdain were. But you can ask questions. And hypothetical questions. The reason we use them is because they are a way to step back from the reality of the issues, so that we can perhaps attempt to better understand them. If someone is told that they have an inoperable, untreatable form of cancer that will, not may, but will result in their ultimate end, is it mentally ill for them to determine that they, by God, will be the agents of their leaving and not wait for the ultimate failure of some chemical process or some multi-million dollar affair that involves a whole bunch of plastic tubes and lines running into their arms and their legs and their necks and their clavicles, and machines going beep all around them? Is it insane for them to say, oh, no, no, absolutely not. I will not tolerate that. That will not happen to me. Is it insanity for somebody who has found out that they are about to live through the hell on earth of having their mind leave them, to desire to leave of their own choosing while they still have a mind to make the decision with? Is that insane? I submit to you that that is the very definition of sanity itself. It is not, it is by no means, I'm not declaring who should or should not. But the fact of the matter is, the judgments that we make in these circumstances contribute to the problem. One of the things that I found out today as a result of coverage of this story is that suicide nationally is up 25% over the last, 10 or so years. The only state in which suicide is not up is Nevada, where suicide just stays at a horrifyingly a high number and kind of camps out there. So, you know, facile answers are seldom helpful or even correct. And we cannot know what drives the decision that someone makes. Now, on the other hand, if the decision is made, say, in a state of profound intoxication of some sort, we can say that the decision was not perhaps rationally reached, or that it was not reached under optimal cognitive circumstances. But we are not at all entitled to pass judgment on someone and accuse them of mental illness or diagnose them with mental illness. I don't even think accuse is the right word. Because they chose to end their own lives. And other cultures, again, I said, this is all wrapped up in stuff in our particular, Western European, because it flows out of the dictates of Holy Mother Church that were adopted in whole by the so-called Protestant movement that turned out not to be very Protestant at all. It was more about the external appearances than it was about the doctrine that sat at the core of it. And then in the United States itself, we've taken that deeply into our core, the core of our beings. And we determine that that's what we feel about it, so that makes it right. And it's not. It's not right. There are any number of cultures that have acknowledged not only the right, but the duty in some cases of people to just go on. We might look at feudal Japan, say in the Edo period, and say that the moment of shame is reason to go out and pull your bowels out of your belly, and say that, well, that's just silly. But it's not necessarily ours to judge. The Romans did not feel the way that we feel about it. The ancients didn't generally. Shakespeare referred to suicide as to play the Roman fool. Well, there were a lot of Romans who made that decision because the alternatives were far more unbearable. Even in relatively modern history, we have examples. Erwin Rommel. You know, we just passed the anniversary of D-Day. Erwin Rommel, the brilliant German general, was in charge of the defenses at the Atlantic Wall. And when it became known that he had been a participant in the plot against Hitler, he was offered a choice. You can either be tried publicly and we're going to torment your family as well as you, or you can commit suicide and you will be given a hero's funeral and your children and your wife will be unharmed. What's your choice? Was he crazy? Of course not. There are many cultures on this planet, and there are many different ways of understanding how a person comports him or herself inside that cultural framework. And frankly, our understanding is probably wrong. With regard to Kate Spade or Anthony Bourdain, we may never know what the ultimate motivation was. We may not even know if it was actually suicide. Both of them were found hanged. Or so we are told. Bourdain's dear friend, the chef Eric Ripert, found him unresponsive. But there are... That's not necessarily dispositive. And we do not know what might have helped that decision along. But at the ground level, I think we feel genuine grief when people that we have made vicariously a part of our lives. I read tributes to Kate Spade from women who said that she had completely changed their approach to how they thought about fashion in their world. That her handbags were lighthearted and joyous and whimsical, and that they were smile inducing. I was completely ignorant of, I recognized the name, but I couldn't have told you if she made shoes or purses or dresses or what. But she touched a lot of lives with the way she approached her own. And a lot of, and people felt a sense of connection to her because of the materiality or the material culture in which she participated. And the same goes for Bourdain. And you know, where I was saddened but not particularly grief-stricken over the passing of Kate Spade, when Agnes and I heard about this morning, Agnes teared up and cried. Because she remembered when Mr. Bourdain so graciously gave some of his time to talk to me on this program, and not once, but twice. And they were absolute thrills for me. Because you can be pretty jaded, but there are always going to be a small handful of people who really get past that jadedness. You know, Darlene adds to the discussion, subject line, you know, relative to so-called, relative to the rightness or wrongness of suicide. What about the poor souls who jumped out of the tower windows on 9/11? Yeah, I wonder how Holy Mother Church feels about that. That's a tough call. And it exposes the problems with ecclesiastical organizations making blanket pronouncements about whose soul is saved and whose soul is damned, and we approach the issue far too simplistically. One of the headlines today read that Bourdain was the Hemingway of food culture. That was what another chef said of him, a person who respected him. And the Hemingway reference is almost irresistible. Because we've come to see that as a rational act, not an irrational one. Alma writes and says, I'm so very grateful to you for being there for all of us who listen to you and support you. I know how you feel about the deep, reflective sadness Anthony's suicide brought to compassion and empathetic minds. I was in tears shortly before your program began this afternoon, and thank you for talking about this epidemic. Unfortunately, says Alma, if I remember correctly, when the lizard brains take power, suicides increase. I've been there twice, but was unsuccessful in my own attempts. I still struggle at times, but thankfully I have a husband who is my protector in this life. I depend on him for my sanity. However, no one can protect one from suicide. Thank you, Alma. Thank you. Thank you for sharing your truth. Thank you so very much. And sadly, do I expect us to become more rational about this? No. And the fact of the matter remains that there are people who should not and do. Among the most horrifying and tragic of the suicides in this country is the elevation in the number of, you know, seventh graders and eighth graders and, in some cases, fourth and fifth graders for whom life has become intolerable and who sense no help and no way out and no better life. I mean, that's part of the reason the It Gets Better campaign was created for LGBT youth. There are no easy answers. David in South Carolina says, seriously, some people could not or would not call a suicide hotline because they know that all the person on the line will do is just try to talk them out of it by following some script. I think that's very well observed, David. Meanwhile, Scott, as well as Flavio have both sort of taken a contrarian approach. Flavio sent an email early on saying, and that POS Kissinger is still occupying space. Once you've been to Cambodia, you'll never stop wanting to beat Henry Kissinger to death with your bare hands, Bourdain wrote in his 2001 book, A Cook's Tour in Search of the Perfect Meal. You will never again be able to open a newspaper and read about that treacherous, prevaricating, murderous scumbag sitting down for a nice chat with Charlie Rose or attending some black tie affair for a new glossy magazine without choking. While Henry continues to nibble nori rolls and ramaki at A-list parties, Cambodia, the neutral nation he secretly and illegally bombed, invaded, undermined, and then threw to the dogs, is still trying to raise itself up on its one remaining leg. That was the other thing that I think drew many of us to Anthony Bourdain, was that he had an unflinching moral and ethical pole star. Oh, sure, it was fun when he called Emeril Lagasse an Ewok, and referring to Alice Waters as a culinary Maoist. Some of the language that he reserved for Rachel Ray and it was funny. But the moral outrage was real. As I said, Scott is in on the as well. Scott observes simply, and Dick Cheney still lives. And I'll say something now that I hope it doesn't get, you know, I hope it doesn't piss you off or anything, but I mean, that's not my goal. But I confess to having a list in moments like this, a sort of ad hoc running list in my own mind of people who should have but haven't. And today, I actually thought that, you know, if I was a little, you know, if I was a Howard Stern type radio guy, and not some little guy down in West Virginia, just trying to keep a conversation going, if I probably would have created a Be Like Bourdain hashtag today, and maybe tweeted, you know, at Dick Cheney, at Jeff Sessions, Be Like Bourdain. But the problem is that the reason the Bourdains and the Kate Spades and the Hemingways do what they do, and the Cheneys and the Rumsfelds don't, and the Kissingers don't, is because the Cheneys and the Kissingers and the Rumsfelds are absolutely suffused within their own selves. And I say self in the sense that it's contemplated in the Hindu concept of Maya. You know, is that the right word? The illusion. And the inability to recognize that, you know, as Buddhism teaches, that this is all suffering. I don't know that I buy into that. But the fact of the matter is, the people who should and don't, because they never do that which Plato mentioned when he said, and this is a paraphrasing, but that the unexamined life is not worth living. And that is an easy thing to throw out there. Wow, you know, Plato said the unexamined life is not worth living. But it's one of those little, it's like a Zen koan. What does that actually mean? It doesn't mean only what it appears to say on its surface. It has deeper currents and deeper subtext. It implies that people who have not engaged in the examination of their lives aren't living. They're not participating in the fullness of the human experience. They should just as well have been born ants, because they're just moving along and going through day to day and you know, feeding the wants and needs of their ids, servicing power, trying to accumulate wealth, and never once actually trying to figure out any portion of what it's all about. And that's what makes, for me, that's what makes that statement profound. If all you've ever done in life is seek the self and seek for self-aggrandizement, how much worth does such a life actually have? Well, the Platos of the world would tell you not much. So you got Plato saying the unexamined life is not worth living. But in the 20th century, and I think it was Camus, was it not Camus? Who essentially said that the only question worth answering in life was whether or not to kill yourself. Now that's a handful of contemplation right there. So all of these things sort of wrap together. Michael in Madison. With a suggestion for a bumper, and I think I'm going to go with Michael's suggestion here, because that fits entirely too well. Meanwhile, Billable Rick says, I was also saddened to hear the passing of Anthony Bourdain. He seemed like a down-to-earth and very real person who was open-minded and fostered understanding among other cultures. Not to mention that Bourdain was enormously talented and just a warm, good-hearted human being. Darth Cheney lives on his fourth virgin heart. And Kissinger is still a senior statesman while Bourdain is dead. Very sad. P.S. When did you have Bourdain on your show? Was food porn the topic du jour? Yes and no. It was broader than that. It was 2006 and 2010. And I just kind of reached out and said, hey, would you? I did that back then. And like I said, he was most gracious, and it was, oh, sure. And it was easy to set up. And it happened as easy as you could want. So I felt like, you know, there were some remarks were necessary, but I wanted to avoid, if at all possible, the facile, the superficial, and particularly the pontificatory. Our dear friend Jude out in the Northwest says, "When I read about how he ended his life, I was stunned, as the person presented always seemed to be internally clear, open-minded, and traveling on a path of purposefulness. So, Bob, I just had a sense it would hit you especially hard, as the interview you had with him was so audibly enjoyable on both ends. One never knows how the inner life of another can be cloaked with secrets. I love you, and we'll keep a candle lit." Thank you, Jude. Thank you very kindly. Marty says, "I was never that big of a Bourdain fan, but to quote T'Pau from Amok Time," obligatory Star Trek reference, thank you, Marty, "I grieve with thee." Yes. Thank you, Marty. And it would not, you know, we would not be America if someone out there had not proven themselves a complete and total and absolute asshole. And courtesy of Michael in Madison, I saw this on his page from PasteMagazine.com. "How not to respond to a suicide, the worst tweet about Anthony Bourdain." And it's a reference to a miserable sack of attempted human flesh by the name of David Levitt, whom I would not know if I passed him on the street, and that's probably a good thing for him. Back when the shooting took place at the Ariana Grande concert in England, Bourdain got on Twitter and just lit him up. Because back when the murders took place at the Ariana Grande concert, he tweeted, "Multiple confirmed fatalities at Manchester Arena. The last time I listened to Ariana Grande, I almost died too." Bourdain responded to that by saying, "You, sir, are truly a steaming, gaping asshole." So today, David Levitt got his revenge on a dead guy. "Selfishly taking your own life and hurtling your friends and family makes you the steaming, gaping asshole, Anthony Bourdain. I'm rubber and you're glue. What bounces off me, it sticks to you." Jesus, what a prick. Yeah, and we probably need to re-examine that sorry, tired old trope about selfish. Suicide may be said to be many things, but among others, it is the absolute abnegation of the self. So let's not talk about suicide being selfish anymore. Talk about people who had a reason to want to check out. Millions mourned the death of Robin Williams, but a lot of people came around and said, "I ain't judging that." But, of course, there were other people who were complete dicks about it. We've pondered it culturally. Simon and Garfunkel and Paul McCartney both did versions of an Edward Arlington Robinson poem called Richard Cory. I believe it was Edward Arlington Robinson. Because we tend to, these are essential questions of the human experience. And Edward Arlington Robinson's poem, Richard Cory, has had a macabre grip on our existential wonderings ever since it was published. Whenever Richard Corey went downtown, we people on the pavement looked at him. He was a gentleman from sole to crown, clean-favored and imperially slim. And he was always quietly arrayed, and he was always human when he talked, but still he fluttered pulses when he said good morning, and he glittered when he walked. And he was rich, yes, richer than a king, and admirably schooled in every grace. In fine, we thought that he was everything to make us wish that we were in his place. So on we worked, and waited for the light, and went without the meat, and cursed the bread, and Richard Corey one calm summer night went home and put a bullet through his head. The juxtaposition of privation and privilege in that poem crawls all over us. So, just one last thing. Rick asked about the conversation I had with Anthony Bourdain. Well, this is a part of it.
I don't know. I mean, intolerance, being a territorial, intolerant, jingoistic, xenophobic, tribalism. I mean, that's something I see a lot of around the world, but it's unlovely to see, in my hometown. I mean, to his credit, our mayor has been very cool about it, to come down on the right side of the issue. Yes, of course, it's enraging. But yes, I want to run right back to where I was. I want to go right back to Italy.
Well, it just occurred to me because there was a strange irony in the fact that the last new episode of No Reservations that aired before this conversation, last week's episode, was Dubai.
Yeah.
And it has to, of course, that's long ago old history in your book, but there has to be something odd insofar as you meet people who are really decent human beings all around the globe, and it comes out in your work. And to see this kind of thing going on in this country has got to be a little bit unsettling.
Well, like I like to say a lot, I mean, I don't have to, I don't have to agree with you to like you or respect you. In fact, I can disagree violently with what you have to say, and I feel I can still sit down, have a decent meal, we can get along, and hopefully respect each other. I think that's the same thing in my heart that allows me to sit down in Saudi Arabia and have dinner with people and at least try and see their point of view to whatever extent I can, allows me to be friends with Ted Nugent, frankly. I don't see any difference between the two. People go berserk and get a lot of angry mail when we shoot a very sympathetic program in Laos, talking about what happened there during the Vietnam War and the effect it's had on people since. I get a lot of howls from the couch Rambos, but I have to say that the wails and screams of horror and outrage whenever we have Ted Nugent on the show are at least as loud and at least as crazed. So it just seems like the level of discourse in the country as a whole has gotten so cartoonish as to avoid a basic civility.
So I take it then from what you just said that I'm not the only one that reads some sort of relevance, and I don't want to sound like some guy who plays records backwards or anything, but that sees some sort of relevance in your work that transcends, if I may, mere issues of food.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any political agenda when I go to a country or to do a program at all. But when you sit down, but by the same token, I'm not going to avoid the elephant in the room. I mean, you learn a lot about a culture by what people are eating, how hospitable they are, literally what's on your plate. It tells you a lot about, what people love, about their culture, where they came from. But it also tells you that if, 80% of their diet is bread, that's you might want to mention why. If your host is missing, three of his four limbs, it's worth asking the question, gee, fella, where'd your limbs go? you know, that alone is a political act. You know, eating is a political act even. So, I guess that's had to kind of leach into the show. And then in the course of making the show, I'm just out there looking to, you know, get drunk, have a good time, and eat. You know, I've been in a few uprisings, insurrections, you know, civil problems, and even a war. So those things do kind of get up and in your face.
Well, and both your TV work and your writing, and I hope you will not take this as an insult, has journalistic qualities to it. And I say not take it as an insult mainly because so much of journalism is insulting these days. That journalistic quality, you come back to America from all these varied and different places, and in Medium Raw, you address issues as varied as the state of the American hamburger. The fact that even so-called foodies, very few of them can actually cook. Whether kids need organic gardens in the back of the elementary school, or whether they need to be able to know that they're not going to get shot going to school that day. All of this started, if I understand your sort of autobiography correctly, with a fairly simple piece for the New Yorker. Was the urge to report always underneath it all, or were you just getting it off your chest?
I think I'm a bit of a provocateur. I think I just kind of can't help that. I think that goes back to it's a childish and childhood impulse. I like to point out the obvious. It seems so many people don't. I just started out writing about my life. You know, like Frederick Forrest said in Apocalypse Now, I'm just a cook, man. I just want to cook. But I was given the opportunity to talk about my life, and that went well. And then people let me travel around the world, eating and drinking, and making television about it. And really, all I wanted to do was report on food. I tell my crew all the time, hey, I'm not Dan Rather here. You know, we're not here to sum up the history of this country or make any kind of commentary. But I do have the luxury of I don't have to neatly sum things up, which is quite a nice privilege. I mean, I can say, as we did at the end of the recent Liberia show, I don't really understand what's going on here, and I don't know how I feel about it. I'm a little freaked out. I'm a little uncomfortable. I'm a little upset. That in itself is a privilege.
Well, the fact that you are willing to let that discomfort show through, I think speaks volumes about why so many people think so highly of your work and that of your crew and your team. When you look back at what you've done and what has been the seedbed of your writing, and because I get this idea, you seem very comfortable and very reverential around people and their local food, and you've done a great deal in terms of teaching people the origins of stuff that they're paying $30 a plate for is actually peasant food from the interior of some heartland somewhere. Are you more comfortable around the workaday working stiff, whether it be in Ho Chi Minh City or
I come out of the fine dining business, all my friends are chefs, and I'm very privileged. I spent a lot of my life eating in fancy, expensive, fine dining restaurants around the world. The places that give me pleasure, that are the most fun, just because I'm a jaded guy for whom fine dining was business, and just as somebody, I guess, for whatever reason. I mean, I'm just happier more often than not, you know, eating street food in Vietnam or at a taco stand in Mexico than I am sitting bolt upright with a tie around my neck choking me in a restaurant.
I don't think I've ever seen that be made more manifest than the Dubai episode last week. the British expat with whom you were having dinner. I swear, Tony, I think I saw you a couple of times looking for exit signs in Arabic.
Well, it was an exquisitely uncomfortable conversation for the both of us, I think, because he was not enjoying my questions, and I was not really enjoying the restaurant. On the other hand, I feel... I can be an angry guy, and I'm angry when I see food fetishized. I'm angered by, the kind of elitism I see. I mean, food has become very, very, people are passionate about food. you know, most of the country, people are passionate about it in an emotional way. It's not really so political. But I'm, you know, when people are dogmatic about food, when people are telling me, you know, you must eat this, you should eat that way, you know, your food must be organic, we must support local, you know, especially when it's somebody, you know, driving an expensive car, making 150 grand a year, I just that troubles me. You know, I don't like that.
Well, organic's all well and good, but how's a mom feeding a family of five gonna make it to the Wild Oats or whatever store and pay $22 a pound for grass-fed or organic free-range beef that died comfortably in Montana?
I'm all for all of those things. I really am. But I mean, you know, those are options for people who can afford. You know, to the extent that we can make those things affordable, great. But I'm not going to make people feel bad about themselves if they, you know, all they have time for in their working lives, or all they have the money for is Popeye's fried chicken.
I hate to admit, but of all the fast food in the world, I like Popeye's best of all. But
you know what? I love their macaroni and cheese. It's utterly disgusting. I'm not even sure there's even cheese in it, but I have an unholy weakness for that stuff. I put a bag over my head and sneak out and get some of that stuff now and again.
Oh God, I'll stop it there, but. It was a delightful conversation, and again, the graciousness with which he afforded time to me and to the community is something for which I will forever be thankful. And yeah, I feel a sense of being diminished by his passing, because in the times in which we live, we need more of him and less of a lot of others. And there's no doubt that he was part of whatever passes for the resistance, because he was merciless in his takedowns of Donald J. Trump. And maybe we'll talk about some of that stuff once we fire up the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable, which we're about to do. Note coming in from Scott in San Diego. I'll begin with this quote. It is not a thing to do while one is not in one's best mind. Never kill yourself while you're suicidal. Edwin Schneidman, 1918 to 2009, American clinical psychologist and suicidologist. That being said, I'm of two minds on the topic. Once, many, many years ago, Scott says, I tried it. I didn't like it, and obviously I wasn't much good at it, thankfully. In a most general sense, I tend to think that it's a personal choice. Life is inflicted upon us all. Some say life is a wonderful gift. It's a nice sentiment, but if we're going to be absolutely real about it, when it comes to such a blanket assertion about life, you must admit that one's mileage will invariably vary when it comes to the giftiness of life. Anyway, if life is forced upon us all, shouldn't we each have a vote in the manner of our departure? I'll close with two quotes. Happiness in intelligent people is the rarest thing I know. Ernest Hemingway died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. And in a real dark night of the soul, it is always 3 o'clock in the morning. F. Scott Fitzgerald died of self-inflicted strong drink. Thank you, Scott. Scott says, and so it goes. Note coming in from Lee a little bit ago. Subject line, suicide. I do not view Kate Spade or Anthony Bourdain as crazy, but I believe that mental health services are the best way to move to a better result. And I agree, Lee, that I did not mean to set up a binary there. That was not my intent at all. And maybe a little bit more open conversation about it might prove to be beneficial. And I will tell you that I have had people reach out to me on this program and say that, you know, that the conversation, not me, but we, the conversations we have here help push back the darkness. Sometimes I wonder how, given how dark it can become, but that's deeply moving, and it's touching, and more than anything else, it is validation of what we do, or what we try to do on any given evening here. And I've found out over the course of all these years now that, you know, people find the program and they hang with the program. Some have been here almost from the very beginning, but not that many. I would hazard a guess that north of 75% of the people who just heard that clip have never heard it before, because there's turnover in the community. And people find this program, and they find this conversation, and they find this sense of community in some ways when they need to. And that in itself is a mystical and inexplicable thing. I'm not trying to assign more meaning to this than it has. But it's special. And that's why every evening I thank everyone for sharing their precious finite time on this planet, engaging in this little conversation. And as much or more than anything else, I take a slightly different tack from Scott on this. If you have the privilege to have had the knowledge and the learning, and I don't necessarily mean by virtue of wealth, but maybe by virtue of culture or a different outlook on life, and I mentioned this a couple of nights ago, you know, the astronomers and the statisticians and the philosophers say that it is almost impossible that we are the only life in the universe. Some will go so far as to say it is impossible. Well, the fact of the matter is, in terms of actual knowledge, this is the only place we know of that has life. And to that extent, and Kurt Vonnegut meditated on this quite extensively, to have gotten to be here, to have gotten to participate in it, to have been what Kurt Vonnegut called sitting up mud, is the rarest of gifts. And gift is probably the wrong word, because that implies a giving, and I don't know that there's a giver out there. But when you look at it, I was talking with a friend earlier today, and I said, really? You get to be life on the only planet that supports it that we actually know of in the entire fucking universe, and you're bored? Piss off. I love life. That is not to say, however, that certain contemplations do not enter one's consciousness. But it has been learned. I don't know that I loved it as much when I was 20 as I love it now that I'm 55. I don't know that at all. And I don't know that there's not something out there that would make me stop loving it. But right now, yeah, I love it to a point of jealousy. And part of the reason I love it the way I do is because of what I've gotten to do for the last 15 years. And that is interact with a community like ours. And for that, I will always say thank you. So we'll take a break. David in South Carolina says, Titanic Radio. I was just thinking, I started listening when you were still on Titanic Radio. You did, I remember. David is one of those happy few. Because I remember getting emails from David, and it kind of blew my mind when I was sitting in the studio in Beckley. David in South Carolina, Stan. Yep. A lot of water over that dam or under that bridge. So let's take our break, and thank you very kindly to Alma for jumping in on Darlene's challenge. That means we got $75 to go with it. Thank you very, very kindly indeed, and hopefully we'll knock that down and maybe even knock down the whole hole in the week, as much as it kind of grieves me to even talk about that on something as tawdry as that during a moment like this. Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. Yeah, The song you're about to hear, suggested by Michael in Madison, is from Tim Heidecker. And he says, it's gotten me through a lot of rough patches lately. The whole album, Michael says, is about Trump. Well, let's see. See what we got here. Thanks, Michael.
Can't call it the White House anymore. Too many stains on that Oval Office floor. Blood and piss. Semen and shit. Burn it all down. We're done with it. Think of the lady who'd have to come in after this. Think of that dirty cheek she'd have to kiss. And some of the old guard are gonna throw a fit. Burn it all down, we're done with it. Ain't it a shame he's too dumb for suicide? Too self-absorbed, too filled with pride. You know, I was reading the news the other day about some trade deal we just made with the Chinese. We're gonna get to sell them some of our banking technologies. And in exchange, they're gonna get to sell us some of their cooked poultry we so badly need. And it got me thinking, oh, it got me thinking, maybe some of that cooked Chinese chicken gonna make its way to his broken heart. Maybe some of that cooked Chinese chicken gonna make its way to his broken heart.
Again, Tim Heidecker. Cooked Chinese Chicken from the album Too Dumb for Suicide. Thank you, Michael. That was a very good counterpoint indeed. 13 minutes past the hour. It is Friday on the front porch on the horn. And without further ado, we should run over and check in with Sparky. Hey, Sparky.
Hey, this is for the show.
You still there?
Can you hear me?
Now I can, yeah. I heard this is I heard this is where
the show goes to pot.
Oh. Cuz I know what you mean.
You want a trip report, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. And a full shopping rundown.
Okay. Well, it just so happened my stepson came back Sunday, but our trip got turned into a auto repair thing, and he had to go to Social Security, so we had to do a lot of running around Reading, and our last stop was to run out to Shasta Lake City and go find Queen of Dragons. So we get off on the Shasta Dam Boulevard exit. And he goes, do you know where this place is at? And I said, I'll know it when I see it. And besides, if we come to the dam, I'll know we've gone too far. Because the road goes all the way to Shasta Dam. That's why it's called Shasta Dam Boulevard. So we come over this little rise, and I look over, and I see the big mural on the side of this building. It's a big, long building. It's longer than a man cave.
And that, I said, there it is right there. So we pull in, we parked the car, walk in the door, and here, you got a register over on this side of the room, and here's this buxom blonde over there to sign you in, just show her your license. And my stepson keeps flirting with her, and she says finally, well, I'll make sure the boys take good care of you. So just walk back there to that wall. So we walk across the empty space. I mean, the place is wider than man cave, longer than man cave. And walk up to there's a counter there, and there's all these jars with all the varieties in them so you could sniff them. And then hanging behind the guy is this rack with all the product hanging in Ziploc. Nice factory Zip bags. So what I bought, I mean, I asked the guy, the dude standing behind the counter, and he could tell he was a stoner just by looking at him. I said, do you have any sour banana sherbet? And he said, no, sorry, that's just for medical.
Darn it.
Instead of arguing with him, because there's like 12 brands of stuff right in front of me. So what I bought was Mr. Nice Flower, which is indica strain, White Widow, which is a hybrid, Super Lemon Haze, which is sativa, and I like really a lot, OG Flower, which is indica, and Blue Dream. And I picked up some gummies, too, from my wife, but she's afraid to try them now.
I'm afraid she'll just get too, yeah. Too potent.
There's like six little doses in there. I mean, six gummies in a little package. You just cut them up.
Oh, you mean you don't just put like one gummy in? Oh, that'll get you flying?
Well, they're a little square, about inch and a half by inch and a half.
Oh, okay. I was thinking more in terms of bears, but, you know, never mind.
It's just a gummy product. It's not a bear. Jesus, Bob.
Well, I mean, we've run four kids through this house. I hear gummy, my brain automatically attaches the word bear.
Okay. Speaking about that, how's your Mach 3 goose doing?
Oh, he's flying wingman even as we speak. He's proudly wearing his patch, and he's sitting up on the mic boom next to the gargoyle.
I didn't realize how big that patch would be on that little jacket.
Well, he's all the prouder for wearing it that way. And of course, you have to say his name, you know. Goose. And you know, Ron and Raleigh. I don't know if I mentioned it on air last week, but Ron and Raleigh sent me a note. I guess they really have got pre-production rolling on Top Gun Part 2. Given the interval of time, I don't know if Tom Cruise, is just, you know, dropped with a crane on his hover round into the jet or what, but, you know. Jesus.
No, Tom Cruise has still got another new Mission Impossible movie coming out.
You know, at some point in time, you have to kind of confess that the missions are probably possible. By the way, you've got some agreement going on. Larry just noted Blue Dream Rocks just got a butt of it today. Go Sparky.
Okay.
So, can you tell an appreciable difference between, say, the indica versus the sativa?
Well, yeah, the Super Lemon Haze had a different effect on me.
Peppy versus downer, or head versus body, a bunch of different language
used. Mostly body relaxation is the whole thing, too. I went to the knee doctor yesterday. I can't get my shots till in July, second half of July.
Alma just dropped a note and said, Blue Dream helps with depression, too. That's good to know. So how long will it last? How long before you have to make your next run to the store?
Well, the one thing I learned, I think mine's broken now. So I didn't tell you about you got to buy a Ziploc child guard bag.
Well, that's a small sacrifice to make for not being classified as a criminal anymore, I think. Yeah.
It looks like that.
Oh, wow. Okay. Can't see into it or anything like that. I wonder if that's a California specific thing or if that's something that's come along.
Oh yeah. You can't go out the door without your bag.
How much do they
get? You also can't.
Do they get you for the bag?
I think my stepson's paid for it, and I just ended up with it.
You also can't open it in the parking lot and take a peek, because they'll come out and tell you that, like, you know, it's illegal to do that. So.
So are there limitations on public consumption?
I think there are. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, just in your home. But, I mean, that is not abided by you. You smell it all the time, all over the place.
Yeah, not enough police.
And that's the first thing you notice when you walk in the store. You can smell a pot.
Well, fuck. My heart bleeds for you.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, Steve. Bob. Hey, Rick. Go ahead, Duncan. I want to hear all about your tale to the bud shop. This is very entertaining.
But I felt like a kid in a candy shop, really, when I was in there. Oh, then to top it off, the dude that was waiting on me, I didn't even notice it. Ryan tells me when we get in the car, he says, did you see that Bob Marley blunt that guy had behind his ear? I said, no.
Yeah, see, I don't.
I wasn't concentrating on looking at him. I was looking at the pot.
Well, at least you had your priorities in the right place, Sparky.
Yeah.
But honest to God, those great big honking blunts and stuff, I don't know how people do it. You know, I guess at this advanced age now, I look at something like that and I start going, dude. You know, just on the osmotic properties.
Oh, and then when we go to leave, he gives us the Buddha sign from Hawaii.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What's the Buddha sign?
Well, your thumb and your...
Well, oh, the thumb and the pinky? I thought that was just hang loose.
Well, hang loose, for me, it was Buddha sign. It's cool. Old 70s pot culture from Thailand, too. We referred to pot as Buddha.
Never heard it referred to that way. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it, and I hope there'll be more trip reports and more tasting reports too. What was that, Steve?
I was just going to say, do you know what really irritates the living shit out of me? We have all this physiological and psychological sickness going around, and we have our hands right on the key that may unlock it. It's not going to be a cure-all for everybody, obviously not, but even if it's 30% cure-all, it's worth unlocking this thing. And why is it only 4 or 5 states have enough sense to say, okay, let's try this?
Well, not to get too analytical, but hey, look, every one of those jurisdictions is a jurisdiction that is not controlled by a Koch brothers legislature.
That's true. So do you think that the alcohol industry is squashing it as much as they can, or the pharmaceutical industry is squashing
it as much as they can? Well, I mean, it's easy to go there, Steve, but I don't know that that's where because they've got the resources to get into business and make a killing. The bottom line is it's just plain old-fashioned bigotry, and most of it is religious bigotry. I mean, we don't. I mean, you know, this is a small state. As Ron and Raleigh pointed out, the single county, the population of the county alone where he lives, is almost ready to surpass the population of my entire state. Okay? We don't have a lot of population here, and yeah, we've got some progressive-minded people, but you know, not enough to put a candidate in office. But the thing is, the chokehold in a place like West Virginia, which would just be a no-brainer to have legalization here, and regulation and taxation. The church, the good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, homosexuals.
They would rather see the masses strung out on opiates, which we all know is destructive.
Well, right, because the Calvinistic nature of evangelical Christianity says that the fact that people are strung out on opiates is directly related to the fact that God doesn't love them like they love the people who aren't, because good people don't become addicts, not in their minds.
God, is that twisted thinking?
Well, it is, but you know what? It's the same. You know, you're lucky in that you've got a relatively deep blue enclave in Atlanta, but it gets pretty bloody red, you know, by the time you get south of the Nat line.
We can get the oil as long as it doesn't have any psychoactive properties, and we're one of only 10 states that are privy to that.
Well, we can do CBD too.
Yeah.
And next year, if the Republicans in the legislature will actually get off their asses and come up with a banking law, people who are dying will be able to get a tincture or a cream or an oil or a pill, but they won't be able to actually smoke any of the, you know, just plain old leaf. It's going to have to be stepped on by some corporate entity for some level of profit.
And this is how effed up Georgia is. Yeah, we can get the oil if you have one of five chronic illnesses, but there's not anybody that distributes it, so you got to take a chance and go out of state, hoping to find it, to bring it back. I mean, it's just, we've lost our freaking minds, man, as a society. And then we wonder why we have all these, you know, physical and psychological illnesses. It's only going to get worse. I really believe that it's the medicine of the future. What Sparky was talking about. I am convinced of that.
But it's also the medicine of the past. See, this is another one of those moments where we don't teach history. I know it seems weird to juxtapose legal cannabis and we don't teach history, but George Washington grew the stuff for consumption, not just for hemp.
Sure.
And it was widely used throughout early America up until the 1930s. And it's not some urban myth that cannabis was suppressed because it was getting in the way of the oil industry. You know, you talk about, is it, and I'm not being dismissive, but you say, is it the booze industry? Is it the pill industry? Well, the whole thing, the whole suppression and criminalization and prohibition begins with the oil industry.
And that all started, what, back in the 20s, 30s, when crude oil became popular?
Yeah.
Do you think that's a coincidence?
Well, no, because the Rockefellers wanted more money.
So they were trying to suppress hemp paper as well.
Sure.
Randolph Scott Hearst, I think.
Yeah, anything that got in the way of the use of hydrocarbons to produce goods for sale in the capitalist stream of commerce had to be gotten out of the way. And then, of course, because it's America, we leaned on, and we preyed upon the inherent racism that owns this country. I mean, that you know, it's
always
bone deep.
Sure.
You know,
good point, Bob.
There's a story out there that says, the 45 caliber semi-automatic pistol was introduced in the U.S. military around the time of the Spanish-American War and the brutal suppression of the Philippines. Well, the 357 Magnum round was introduced as a result of hysterias that claimed that those black bucks all hopped up on their marijuanas can't be stopped by a simple 38 special bullet. It takes a lot to put them down. And that's how come law enforcement in all kinds of jurisdictions, I know here in West Virginia for years and years and years, carried 357 Magnum Smith & Wesson revolvers.
And the propaganda they would spread about how it's going to make black men crazed and they're going to go out and rape the white women.
Reefer Madness was really funny to for my generation. It was really funny to get all stoned and go to the midnight movie and watch Reefer Madness and sit there and snicker in your wastedness. But the fact of the matter is, when Reefer Madness came out, it came out and was introduced into the public as deadly serious fact.
Absolutely. That was produced by the government, wasn't it?
Not necessarily by, but I think at the behest of. Yeah.
Jesus.
Alma, who, again, Alma got us started on Darlene's challenge tonight. Thank you again, Alma. Alma says, I got off of opioids due to this cannabis program. I just sent in my 6-year renewal today. It really has saved my life thus far from debilitating pain physically and psychically.
It's statistically proven that it can be done. We have the numbers. It's there, right in front of us. Sidney Blumenthal has went out on the floor of the house and has preached this shit till he was blue in the face. But he's just crying into the wind. Nobody hears him, you know? It's frustrating. It is very frustrating.
This is Irwin. I get CBC. I'm up here pretty close. I'm in Montana. I'm pretty close to Canada.
Hey, Irwin. Good to hear from you, friend.
Thank you.
Irwin.
Hi. I was reading the other day that Canada is looking at legalization right now, and I read a little bit about it, the debates between the conservatives and the liberals and the Native Americans and or the First Nation people. So they're ahead of us as usual, I'm hoping they'll work out all the kinks and maybe we'll follow suit. I guess time will tell.
Well, it's awful good to have you in the conversation, Irwin. Welcome.
Thank you. Yes, I have to admit that I grew pot when I was a junior in high school in a little town in Montana. I was more interested in the plant than smoking it, actually. But the sheriff at that time, I think he must have watched Reefer Madness almost every night because he thought it was just like heroin. And we heard him talk about it, you know, it was just like heroin. And as it ended up, my brother-in-law ended up being the sheriff later on. Word got around that I had grown pot. And so when I moved back to North Dakota, he came to our house one time. The first thing he wanted to do is go to my garden and look at my garden. See if I was growing
just
pot.
To make sure.
Yeah. But I wasn't. But I think it just has a lot of good things about it that should be.
Well, the potential is limitless, and the fact that it's still scheduled as a Scheduled One drug is just beyond craziness. Meaning it has no medicinal purposes. They throw it in the same category as heroin or LSD or methamphetamine. How ridiculous is that?
Yeah, to still have that attitude at this time.
When we know, like Alma said, we know it's proven that it will help you on different levels. And there's different strains. It's not a one-size-fits-all. It's like Duncan was saying, I don't know how many strains he's seen, but different strains are tailored for different illnesses. I mean, we're talking anything from, you know, autoimmune disorders to back pain, you know. And why we are not embracing this instead of just, you know, pushing these poisonous opiate pills down people's throats, it's to me, it's just beyond belief, and it's frustrating, and I really don't even like to overthink it because I'll get pissed off, you know, and
plus,
life's,
you know,
too short.
You know, plus another thing, Steve, it's just damn fun. You know, forget about the medicinal qualities, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, but
yeah,
see, in
true.
In the discussion for legalization, you can't talk about it being fun, Billable Rick,
fun.
Because
no.
Fun is the antithesis of murk and exceptionalism.
Right, right. We're like Puritans, after all, right? We can't have fun.
Even though alcohol is a social lubricant, and they've known that forever, you know.
But look what alcohol does, though. It's so much
more. Oh, my God. It eats your liver. It eats your kidneys. It eats your brain. I mean,
yeah.
it's horrible.
Causes violence, you know, yep. All sorts of, you know, families breaking up, all kinds of nasty things it does. Drunk driving, you know.
But it's okay. I can get in my car within 5 minutes, get all the beer I want, you know, to kill myself if I wanted to.
Well,
there you go.
You keep drinking that Bud Light and you will, Steve.
You were waiting for that, Bob. Give yourself a count, though.
Well, thank you. I mean, I'm just...
There was a Surgeon General's warning on Bud Light.
I've got a little memo up here. Wait for Steve to mention beer, then bring up Bud Light.
Oh, I love you, brother. You guys are great, man.
Well, that's high compliment coming from the man who gave us the bubblegum line. That's going to live in horn history. You realize that?
Oh, yeah. Well, that just came from the gut, too, you know. Somebody was talking about
wait a minute, that year. Came from
but
the
I,
gut.
I remember the prep. Yeah. It's the prep. It's not the actual test. The tests tell you're asleep. It's the prep and having to go to the bathroom 30,000 times until you're raw. And I thought, man, is that a cricket? Is that a piece of bubble gum I swallowed back in 73? What the hell is that, you know?
Wait, I didn't think it was possible to improve on it, but you just did. Is that a cricket? How in God's name could it have possibly been a cricket, Steve?
Well,
or do
you know,
we just really not want to know? Is this something that happens on a full moon in August when they're really out there chirping and the moon comes up and you... And the, like the hair sprouts out and the must have crickets.
Now maybe it crawled in my mouth while I was sleeping. That's the way my mind works.
They're pretty good French fried.
Well, they say the average human eats, you know, how many bugs per year in the night? They crawl in your mouth. It's gross, but it's one of the crazy stats that are out there.
And now
they
we're.
They serve them in San Francisco in the stadium out there.
Hey Scott, how are you?
Good. They said,
hey Scott,
you get five. Then you get $5 worth of crickets. It's about 15 or so, and it's a big. You get it. You get a little like it's like a shot glass, a large shot glass full of crickets. And the big thing there is you go and you pound the shot glass full of crickets, and then you pound a beer.
Hey, Grandpa, what's for supper?
But I guess my point is when you're going through the...
We got French fried crickets and turtle spleens. Yeah. A fitting, and you know what? In itself, a fitting tribute to Anthony Bourdain, who said he was not afraid to eat it, you know, that if it is offered and it's rude not to eat it. You don't go into grandma's house and tell grandma you don't want her cooking.
Well, I didn't know that affected you on such a personal level, and now I realize that it did and understand why, and you know, I'm deeply saddened for you, Bob, and everybody that was affected by it.
Well, you know, he did. It was in the early part of this century, just after the turn of the century, that you started getting, with the expansion of cable channels and whatnot, you know, there was food TV. And the first time I ever saw Bourdain, I knew I was watching something that was radically different from Rachel Ray telling people how to stiff people on the tip and get by on $20 a day in Rome. There was an episode in Mexico, and I have a fascination with Mexico's ancient history and everything,
mm-hmm.
but they had gone down to Oaxaca, and someone provided, you know, because he wouldn't sit there and say, this is delicious, he wouldn't lie, and so there was footage of him eating basically an iguana tamale. And it didn't look good. And he said, in the voiceover, he said, oh, that was awful. It made me want to pluck my eyeballs out, dip my head in a bucket of lye, and walk off a cliff.
And Bob, when did you interview him? How old was that tape that you rolled earlier?
That was 8 years ago. That was 2010. But there had been another one in 2006.
Which, in the big scheme of things, just seems like a couple of months ago, you know?
No, it feels like 10 years ago. I listen to that recording, and maybe others don't, but I hear a different me.
It sounds like a young Bob, that's for sure, Bob.
I heard Mr. Kincaid, you know?
Different voice to me, a little bit, yeah.
A little bit different.
Sounded like you did in the old days, Bob.
Yeah. Precisely, Sparky. That was the old days.
I remember that interview. I was around back then.
Yeah, I mean, it blew my mind. I checked this morning to see if I could figure out a way to find it. And, yeah, I was like, whoa, 2010? And then you start thinking about what 2000, wow, just wow. And, you know, just a
so
spry.
Going back to another subject here that you had touched on earlier, you were talking about Reefer Madness and it being a government film and so forth. I saw that when I was in fifth grade as part of a drug prevention program. For real. It was a real, you know, they were actually showing it in the classroom. And then they had, you know, people come in and talk about drugs. The local police telling you all about marijuanas and pills, uppers. I was in fifth grade. It was about 65, I think, somewhere around there, 1965. It was still happening then.
I always remember the voice, for some reason or another, the voice of Jack Webb in Dragnet.
Mm.
That's right. They call them uppers, hippers, poppers, speed. Yeah.
Yeah, that was. Yeah, so that was my first introduction to Reefer Madness. Was that the thing? Was I think our teacher was young. She was just out of college, and she probably got the joke. We were still a little young. We hadn't quite gotten there yet, but she I think got the joke, because she was kind of put off by the whole thing, but she let them do their, you know, as part of this, you know, the school curriculum, and they had to do it. But you could tell it wasn't part of her. She really didn't want to be there.
Speaking of Joe Friday.
You didn't do it that
time. I don't know. Where'd that go? Wait a second.
I don't know.
Okay, okay, I know what that is. No? Okay, get rid of that. Ah, there we go. Okay. This is one of those. This is one of those drug speeches from Dragnet that young people who were known as boomers now looked at that and went, well, okay, we're being lied to again.
I'll tell you what I know. I know that, in fact, too many kids that begin with pot end up with heroin, then on to LSD. I know that if you drink, you suffer a loss of judgment, if you drink to excess. But I also know that judgment returns when you sober up. I know, and so do you. When you flip out on an acid trip, you never know when you're going to slip out again. This is now, Bentley, not a couple of years ago. We've had time now to see and study the effects of LSD. People who haven't had a dose in weeks sail out on another trip. They never know when. The minute they drop one acid capsule or ingest it in any way, they bought the farm. They've lost any chance to depend on and even restore that most precious of all inner senses, judgment. And in my way of thinking, without judgment, you might as well be dead. Your brain is, so why not the rest of you?
We were talking about marijuana.
We still are. Marijuana is the flame. Heroin is the fuse. LSD is the bomb. So don't you try to...
It's the bomb, man.
Marijuana, mister, not with me. You may sell that jazz to another pothead, but not to somebody who spends most of their time holding some sick kid's head while he vomits and retches sitting on a curbstone at 4 o'clock in the morning. And when his knees get enough starch back in him so he can stand up and empty his pockets, you can bet he'll turn out a stick or two of marijuana. And you can double your money. He'll be holding a sugar cube or a cap or two. So don't you con me with your mind expansion slop. I deal with kids every day. I try to clean up the mess that people like you make out of them. I'm the expert here. You're not.
Yeah, only problem was he wasn't.
Yeah, right.
The only problem was... Wait. I don't want to put too fine a point on it. The only problem was he was lying!
Yeah, but I never had any flashbacks, believe me.
If there was any truth to that, I'd owe to every farm in the state of Georgia and Maryland.
Well, but wait, you know, I mean, there's a moment in that thing. Don't just let it blow by. Consider the hierarchy. Yeah, it starts with marijuana, but after that, it's on to heroin, and then LSD. What, Edith, huh? No, really? Really? LSD's worse than heroin there, Sergeant Friday?
Hey, Bob, I skipped the heroin part.
Just went straight to the acid, did you?
Yeah, right. So it was all the marijuana.
Yeah, never mind the staring at your shoelaces part. Just move on to the breathing walls. But, you know, that's what made the problem worse. When you lie to people about something and it turns out they find out you're a liar, then everything else is... And you can probably make the same argument relative to the opioid crisis. You know, well, they lied to us about pot. They lied to us about acid. Probably lying about these pills, too. And you know, Rush Limbaugh survived. All he had to do was go and pet a horse in Arizona for 6 weeks, and he was all better. And the front end. Well, yeah, I know a person can drink, but if they drink to excess, they've got their judgment back the next morning. That must have been paid for by the American Distilling Institute.
I don't guess dude ever had a really bad hangover, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, he might wake up in the morning with puke in his shoes, but he can always wash his shoes, but you can't wash the marijuanas out.
Oh, see, when I knew that, I knew it was all done in a lie when I got high the first time and said, this is fun. Because I know the first time I got...
Overs.
Well, when I first got drunk, I got sick.
For a couple of days.
And, you know, and boy, I didn't want to eat anything. I didn't want I didn't want to touch alcohol, and I didn't for a long time.
Yeah, I just want to just want to sit there in the dark and hear nothing, see nothing, you know, right.
But then I got high, and it was fun. I wanted to go do things.
Hey,
it wears off in a few hours.
And by the way, Robert in Australia with a recommendation for us. The colorized reefer madness is a real treat. Purple haze is real. Mind you, says Robert, any film with 35-year-old teenagers is always a real treat.
Yeah, I should look that up. I haven't seen Reefer Madness since my stoner days a long time ago. So we used to go do the midnight showing.
By the way, I had a note from Arnold, Arnold said, when I took a trip to California a month ago, I ordered 4 joints delivered to my hotel room, and it was an amazing experience smoking on my balcony and not feeling like a criminal.
Oh, yeah, some towns have delivery services.
Now, Duncan, I got a question. Don't you have to have, like, a local license before you can make a purchase? Is that a thing, or...
No.
No?
To visit a licensed dispensary?
That's only right. If it's a medical card. If it's with legality, you don't need that. It's slightly less expensive.
It's recreational now.
Yeah, but it's recreational now, so...
So, I could, or anybody could go there with an out-of-state license and just get the same thing you did.
Yeah.
Yep. My stepson has a Nevada license, but...
Yeah, that's why it's a tourism draw.
He says the stores in Reno are better than this one. But...
Well, and you don't, you know, like Colorado, you don't have to show a Colorado license. That would defeat the entire economic purpose. You know? I mean, that's why...
Prove you're 21 years old.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to be a Colorado license, no.
Closest dispensary for me is Massachusetts, and it may be time to check out Salem.
Let me just check in real quick, because we've got some listeners in the greater D.C. area where it is sort of legal. Have any dispensaries opened in the legal part of D.C., or are they just not, is it not that far advanced? Because it's my understanding that it's severely curtailed in D.C., like you can't use it in the area that's the jurisdiction of the Capitol Police, for instance, and that takes in, you know, smoking a joint on the mall or you know, up there where our little AIC headquarters were and those condos and townhomes and that old federal architecture blocks back behind Capitol Hill. But the other parts, I don't know if there are any dispensaries or not. Oh, but I do have a little bit of good news after all the Trader Joe's talk. Yeah, I will be visiting a Trader Joe's when we go up there later this month. And I don't know from what Todd said, I may have to roll the dice and get a 6-pack of that Trader Joe's house brand Kolsch. That sounded awfully good.
I'm sure they got Bud Light, Bob, for a default for you.
Hey, I Google.
I had some good Kolsch in San Francisco, just this local beer. I don't know what it was called, but it was delicious. Went out and shot some pool after my trial was over. And
Were you at a disadvantage because the pool table was actually level, Rick?
No, actually, it was the best pool table, one of the best ones I've ever played on, even though it looked like the felt looked like it was all torn up and stuff. I mean, it was just older, but it was really a true roll, you know? You know, there was like no table, you know, like most tables have quirks in it. This was like really, you know, the balls rolled the way they should, you know?
So you sound like a bit of a billiards aficionado. Is that safe to say?
I am.
Well, then I got the place for you.
Okay.
If you ever get back east this way, you need, I think it's still open. Somebody in northern West Virginia can correct me if I'm wrong. But there's an institution in Morgantown, the home of West Virginia University, my alma mater, Harvard on the Mon.
Right.
It's been open since before the First World War.
Oh.
And, in fact, there are World War I doughboy recruiting posters on the wall, or there used to be. And it's simply called the Met Pool Hall because it sits beneath the old Metropolitan Theater where people like Burns and Allen played on the vaudeville circuit. And they've got 8-foot single slates. They've got actual billiard tables, what ain't got no pockets, and you play that game where you chase the balls around the table all day long. And you know, none of those annoying bullshit put a bunch of quarters in machines. You go up, the guy writes your name down and what time you signed on, and you play by the hour.
Okay.
Or used to.
Fun.
Or used to. Yeah, it was an institution. Yeah. Mm. And, you know, cold beer and, right.
Hey, Bob, you just see that map I put in the chat?
Hang on here. No, I did not. I was checking in.
Those are weed stores in Washington, D.C. area.
Oh, no kidding.
No kidding.
Are you planning a visit there, Sparky?
Well, no. I didn't know they were there.
I might.
Steve, I had a feeling it might be closer than you thought.
Yeah. No kidding. I'll have to call first to see what their restrictions are. I'd hate to ride all the way there and say,
Oh, no, Wellness Center, Capital City Care. No, you have
places. You can look them up that way.
Yeah, that looks like those look like medical establishments.
That's what I'm afraid of, yep.
Of course, you could always walk in and say, my lumbago's acting up. Oh,
I got a migraine.
Clarity's with us this evening. Clarity had a gig last week. How'd the gig go, Clarity?
Oh, it was wonderful. It was a perfect day. It wasn't too hot. And just before we started playing, the wind died down. And we all kind of sounded. And for an outdoor gig, that says a lot because there's so many things that, you know, are different than playing indoors.
More variables.
Oh, absolutely. And we haven't heard back how much money they raised, but food was good. But what I wanted to talk about, you know, the first subject matter that rolled around, I went to my dispensary, which is a half hour bus ride east of here on the east end of the county, because the west end is all we don't have dispensaries allowed.
And your county is the size of some states, isn't it?
It's, what did I figure? It's 10 times the size of San Francisco County. It's 49 square miles, so it's 490 square miles, I think, is the county here. Something like that. Anyway, I was looking to refill my Blue Dream, and they were out of it. That's my new favorite vapor. And they were also, I was looking for Lemon Haze. They were out of that. So I got, you'll go like this, Pineapple Express and Chernobyl.
Well, that just sounds ominous as hell.
Yeah, their Chernobyl is one of those, what you were talking about earlier, not feeling like a criminal, you know, when you're out just kicking back, smoking a doob. And
do you feel like you've just been nuked after having that, Clarity?
Well, the way I like to describe a good sativa is your third eye, the middle of your forehead, feels like it's melting sand. I think that's the best way I can describe a sativa. But I was just going to say that, we don't have to get the paranoia blues anymore. It's just a sign that you have a really excellent sativa. But that's not what I came to talk to you about either.
Okay.
Tomorrow we're going to go in here into the local high school auditorium and record a live demo. And we're excited about that because that's kind of between us getting some better jobs. We don't have a decent recording of the band. And it costs too much to do a real studio recording. So we're looking forward to that. And we've got a new sub that we got to work in before our next gig. That's July 7th. And I found out that my niece, she's my brother's youngest child, who we didn't even know he had a youngest child until she was in her mid-30s. And just before he went out to Vietnam, he had a fling with some girl. And I don't know how he kept it a secret. But anyway, she's coming, and she's going to stay at the Red Lion with us and bring her girlfriends. And I've only been with her one other time, because she lives on the other side of the state, and we run in different circles. But I'm really looking forward to that gig coming up. And my voice feels pretty good in spite of one of the worst allergy springs I can remember. Just everywhere you go, there's pollen just piled up on the sidewalks. So that affects my voice somewhat. The antihistamines I have to take to be able to breathe, dry out my throat, you know. But that's all. I just, you know, in Oregon, we got the governor race is starting to heat up. Found out that the Republican that's running against Kate Brown was the minority guy in the state Senate. I don't follow state politics that much. But he's, you know, kind of a prosperity gospel, Trumpansy light, you know, and they're going at Kate Brown about the budget because she has not relented about covering every Oregonian. You know, she signed a 5-year contract, you know, with Medicare. So she's hoping that by the time that's towards the end, which is 2022, that we will have everybody covering the state. But she's in this biennium, we're down about $1 billion. So they're trying to paint her as, you know, the most ultra liberal governor in the United States today. And so there's a lot of money coming in, you know, dark money that's, you know, trying to pick at her anyway they can. I really respect the woman. She's a good politician, and she's taken, you know, she's never relented on her support of the gay, lesbian, transgender, et cetera, alphabet soup coalition here. And at least that's one of the good things about Oregon is, you know, we have a female attorney general, a female governor, a female secretary of state, and it's you know, I feel like we're in good hands here. But on this side of the state, it's a man's world.
And I was going to say, I saw the poster, the picture you posted in the Skype chat, and I got to compliment you on the pigtails. Those are adorable, Clarity.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm not being ironic.
I'm just starting to wear my hair down, and I don't know what the hell to do with it. I'm waiting until the second anniversary of my start of it, when I broke my collarbone. I couldn't reach up, you know, couldn't get up to shave my head. So I started from scratch on July 12th of 16. I had a little bike accident. And, yeah, that was quite a year, 16, because I closed out the estate, moved in a new place, had two fractures, and then we had that hellish winter. You know, 40-year winter.
Oh, yeah, that was the hateful winter, yeah.
Yeah, and I spent about half of it with a cast on my arm. So I was next to worthless.
Yeah, that wrecks your balance a little bit.
It sure does. And I was afraid because I had one time before when I hurt my right arm and I overcompensated, and right after I got through with PT and I hurt my left arm because I was baking, you know. So it pays to always be doing a little bit of strengthening and stretching stuff. I think it does help you, you know, gives you a little bit more agility and lowers your likelihood of falling down. And not drinking tequila anymore. That's really increased my likelihood.
That's really the key to the not falling down part.
I think so. Yeah. But, you know, I kind of went the same stages, you know, as a late teen. I didn't really get into drugs until my senior year. I mean, I started smoking pot when I was 15. But, you know, the pot came from a different dealer, and the heroin came from a different dealer. So, yeah, you definitely had to change plans because the same guy didn't have the, you know, the drugs that took you all the way through the, you know, the gauntlet to get you to LSD, you know. And have your brain made into silly putty, as Jack Webb liked to say.
Well, you know, I always remember the words of the late great prophet Bill Hicks, peace be upon him, who said, talking about psychoactives, said, LSD will get your third eye squeegeed clean. Yeah. All right. I guess Steve's gonna. Steve had to bail on us. Steve, good night and take care and be well and have a wonderful weekend. A little update on Agnes, who is the research department this evening, tells me that yes, the Met Pool Hall is still there in Morgantown, West Virginia. Rick, if you ever have to come to Morgantown to do some sort of highfalutin defending kind of work. And it's a special place indeed. So it's 7 minutes past the hour. There's a $100 challenge on the table. We are $25 into it. We need $75 more to meet that, at which point we will have only $240 to go to finish fundraising on the evening. And it would be awfully nice if we could, because that's the only way we keep all of this on the air. So, you know, that's where it is. Erwin, were you going to say something?
I had emailed you earlier about the concert here in Missoula, Montana. We don't get too many concerts, but we had Steely Dan and the Doobie Brothers last night. So,
well, Steely Dan minus either the Steely or the Dan, depending on how you look at Walter Brecker.
Yes. Donald Fagen. About the first thing he said was, unfortunately, my partner isn't here. Something came up called death. And he's really an interesting guy to listen to. And it was a good concert. Basically, he has an all new band. It's just him. But he really has some really excellent musicians with him now. So I highly recommend them. And the Doobie Brothers are really good too. Johnson, one of the original members, he's singing. If anything, he's improved, I think. And Michael McDonald wasn't there, but so it was.
I have to say, Erwin, for me, that's a plus.
Yeah, kind of me too.
I was never a fan of the Michael McDonald era of the Doobies. I like the pre-Michael McDonald Doobies.
I think that was a more commercially successful album, the Minute by Minute album.
No doubt of
the Doobies, but a lot of true fans, you know, didn't like the change, you know, in the band.
Oh no, those early albums like Toulouse Street and What Once Were Vices Are Now Habits.
Yeah,
those are fantastic albums. You know, the underappreciated stuff, South City Midnight Lady. That's the Doobie Brothers to me.
Yeah, I saw them at Dodger Stadium as part of the Classic West. Both of those bands, both the Doobies and I guess they call it Steely Dan. It's really just Donald Fagen and a bunch of other, you know, folks. They all sounded really good.
I'd love to see a show like that. Now I tell you what. I'm here in West by God, Virginia, so I don't have any concert reports, but I can tell you that the other night. Entirely unintentionally, Agnes and I went down a YouTube wormhole that began with a compil, and you know, you didn't hear, it's not the whole song, it's just clips, and you're sitting there making notes going, oh, I'm going to find that one, got to find that one. Billboard Lost Hits of the 80s. Oh my God. I mean, stuff that I hadn't thought about probably since the first time I heard it. And it was just it was revelatory, because I'm one of those nerds that actually liked the 78 to 85, there was kind of a flowering, really melodic stuff, somewhat technical electronic, but just fun music, and we kept looking at each other going. No. Yes. Yeah. So that was a lot of fun.
Hey, I got some concert news to report.
Yes.
I saw the Monkees on, or what's left of them, Mickey and Mike show, Mickey Dolenz and Michael Naismith, last Saturday night at a small theater in LA called the Orpheum.
I've heard of it.
You know, it's interesting how the band has changed. I mean, they don't try to pretend they're the Monkees, but it's like the Monkees present the Mick and, the Mickey and Mike show or whatever. And, you know, they didn't sing, the Monkees song, hey, we're the Monkees, that whole song. But they did do a lot of the other songs. And, they almost at times sound like a country bluegrass band in terms of the vibe. I mean, it was thoroughly enjoyable. Star loved it because she likes country a lot. It was a good show. They played for probably an hour straight, and then they took about a 15-minute break and then played maybe another hour, So it was a really, really good show. I'm glad I went. And
I think Mickey and Mike is probably better than Monkey Parts.
Yeah, probably so. But, they had an album a couple of years ago that they played a lot of songs from, and the crowd seemed to, recognize the songs. I didn't know the songs, but it was, they were very, very good and, great musicians. There's no doubt about it. And speaking of music, I got just found out that there's a bunch of free concerts in downtown L.A., starting on Saturday, July 14th, continuing through Saturday, August 11th, I guess. There's six concerts. And the first week, the lineup is not set, but I went ahead and got my free tickets to it. But the second week, the Psychedelic Furs is already sold out. They're playing as well as...
Oh, that'll be a good... I bet that'll be a good show.
I know, it's sold out. So I'm going to try and just show up and see if... there's a way to get in, maybe if people don't, use their free tickets, that kind of, which is kind of a Latin band based in LA, along with Jenny and the Mexicats. But August 4th, it's the All-Stars, and August 11th is Pat Benatar and Neil Giraldo, as well as somebody named Lucy. And then on August 18th, it's Smash Mouth along with...
that might be fun.
The Spin Doctors is the second band. Yeah, so...
Oh, those will both probably be a blast. Sounds like you've got a busy dance card. Well, let me suggest, since we spent a lot of time talking about Bourdain, or I did earlier in the program, for members of the Horn Family Community Congregation in the L.A. area... or wider environs, because it's spread out. if you want to do a remembrance of Bourdain, make your way to your nearest In-N-Out Burger. He absolutely freaking adored In-N-Out Burger. So.
So do I. In-N-Out Burgers are great.
If I had a Popeyes anywhere nearby, I would go and you know, lift a spoonful mm-hmm. of mac and cheese in his honor.
That sounds like a good idea, Bob. I'll probably do that.
They're all over Reading now.
Yeah, I've got one. I've got one like about a mile and a half from where I live.
Oh, Rick, I gotta ask you. You gonna find a sports bar tonight to watch the Warriors?
Oh, yeah. You know what? I forgot the game was on. What time's it start? Six?
6 o'clock.
Okay, well, there's a San Francisco sports bar just down the street from me called the SF Bar and Grill. And when they were having the finals last year, it was like standing room only. If you weren't there like 2 hours ahead of time, you know, you couldn't get a seat. So I may do that. That might be a good way to celebrate a Friday. It was a... you know, kind of a busy week, especially the first part of the week with my trial. I finished it on Wednesday, and then the client was nice enough to take me out to a steak dinner afterwards at Morton Steakhouse. And it was either that or get on my plane and leave for the, you know, go back to L.A. And he put me up for another night at the hotel.
Well, hey, maybe by going to Morton's, you worked your magic relative to Rush Limbaugh. You know, they used to advertise with him.
Oh, well... Maybe I did.
I'm sorry. It was Ruth's Chris. I unhex Morton's. I take that back.
But the nice thing about it, after my trial ended, he was very happy with what I was able to do. I only had about I got the case maybe a month before it was due to go to trial, and so I relied on what my colleague who couldn't try the case had done. He's like probably 80 some years old and just couldn't do a trial anymore. Just too stressful for him. And so I was able to get up to speed pretty quickly. But the client was nice enough to put me up, an extra night, even though I could have flown out right after the trial on Wednesday, and ended up, doing a walkabout yesterday. I worked out at the gym and then I slept in, had a nice breakfast at the hotel. Then I went on a walkabout after our workout and walked about 5 miles. I went all over the place and I was along Fisherman's Wharf. I went to the Crooked Street, Lombard Street. I don't know if you've ever seen that, Bob. It just kind of winds around like crazy. And, so after I made my way up there, I went down into the wharf near the harbor and stuff and was like walking along the wharf, and there's a tower called the Coit Tower that sits on a bluff overlooking.
Yeah,
the ocean.
That's the one that that's the one that O'Reilly wanted the terrorists to bomb.
Oh, is that right? Oh, geez, what a douche. So anyway, I was looking for a street to like find my way up to the tower. It was not clear how to do it, and I asked this lady. You know, she seemed to be a local. I said, hey, do you know how to get to Coit Tower? And she said, no, I don't. And turned out she was from Switzerland. So we ended up like walking, around, and we ended up finding a way up to Coit Tower. And I just worked out about an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours before. And I was like walking up those stairs and she was like kicking my ass. She was just going really fast. And I was like huffing and puffing. I mean, you have to walk up probably, I don't know.
Lady, my lungs are bleeding.
Steps. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And she turns out she was from like Zurich. She was in town or near Zurich. She was in town with her sister. And we ended up getting up towards the tower, like where the driveway is. And we were going to go and see the tower, but it was like a line to get in and they were charging it. And I had to catch a plane. You know, I had to leave for the airport by 5:30. So, but that was fun. That was a lot of fun. She was in good shape. She's a skier. I guess she does a lot of skiing. And, I think the Swiss probably walk a lot more than Americans do. But, I mean, I was like
on
totally
slopes. Skiing. You know, on yeah, slopes yeah. They walk.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll tell you what, that burned so much fat. I mean, I was dogged by the time I got back to the hotel. I had to, like, put on my souvenir T-shirt because my, shirt was soaked, and it, you know, and this is despite the fact it's like it's sunny. I had a short sleeve shirt on, and the wind was blowing. It was like 61 degrees, but I wasn't cold. You know, I was just sweating my ass off, and you know, it was a good workout. You know, I was gonna take the cable car on the way back from my walk, but I just didn't have time to find the route. But I guess that's next time. But
What did Mark Twain once write? The coldest winter I ever spent was summer in San Francisco.
Yeah. Well, you know, everybody else had like, you know, long sleeve, you know, sweaters or even, you know, parka jackets on. I was just out there, you know, with jeans and my t-shirt. I had a Cubs jersey wrapped around me, but I didn't put that on because I was never cold, you know. But San Francisco is known for having cooler weather. That's for sure.
Now, I'd love to get back out there sometime.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's been kind of an odd Friday on the front porch, but I think we would be remiss given our job here, if we did not have some level of remark upon the absolute madness of the stream of unconsciousness that emanated from the president's mouth this morning, in which he unlimbered himself of opinions on just about everything. Did you catch any of that, Rick?
Is Russia speech?
Yeah, I did.
Well, Russia plus, you know?
If Russia is smaller than the smallest of the G7 powers, which is Italy. And the reason why Russia got kicked out of the G8 is its frickin' invasion of
Crimea.
Of Ukraine, or Crimea, and annexation of it.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like, you know, Trump is just, you know, and he still thinks that Muhammad Ali needs a pardon, you know?
Yeah, let's clarify that real quick. May we?
Sure, let's do it.
How do you pardon somebody whose freaking conviction was overturned by the Supreme Court? Is that just stupidity, or is there something more nefarious at foot that he wants to show that his word is greater than that of the ability of the Supreme Court to adjudicate issues?
Well, maybe this is a shout out to all of his, African American supporters. Bob,
right. Because African Americans have, of course, been voting Democrat for 100 years. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But no, I mean that quite seriously. Some people said, "Well, you know, he's so damn stupid. He doesn't did nobody tell him that Muhammad Ali's conviction was overturned by the Supreme Court?"
Well, he obviously didn't know. Well, I don't know.
He didn't know it to begin with. Some idiot staffer gave him that information.
Well,
maybe.
But consider the point that I'm trying to reach here.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that, you know, the Supreme Court is the final arbiter of law in this country.
Right.
And they've already overturned the conviction.
Mm-hmm.
But he feels like he still has a right to pardon something they overturned. That's actually a pretty significant statement relative to the jurisprudence of the United States.
Well, you're assuming that he knew that the conviction was overturned.
Well, yes, I am. And if in fact I'm right, that's stunning.
He is the law, basically. I can keep this country together, whatever the fuck he said at his during his speech at the convention, you know. I alone can do this. I alone can do that, you know. and you know, the thing is, the Republican Party hasn't done anything to dissuade him from that belief. They've just sucked up to him, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the Russia business, as Sparky alluded.
Yeah.
The idea that Russia needs to be readmitted to the G7. You know, I was simply reminded when I, in real time, when he said that, I thought, Yeah, there's that article from a couple of weeks back where the NSA said they knew he was a foreign agent as far back as this time of year, 2016.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of confirmed it, didn't it? And the fact that he constantly says, "No one's been harder on Russia than me. No one."
Yeah. Right. Oh, God. Oh, I don't know how many spleens I've spit up in the last year and a half, Bob. I think I'm going on about 100 now. Oh, my God, you know? It's like nothing makes, you know, again, I think part of this is, I think it's a strategy to get people so they don't trust themselves and they get, you know, to induce vertigo in people, you know, that so they don't know what's up, what's down, you know, what's right, what's wrong, whatever, you know?
Yeah, well, exactly. I think vertigo is a good word. The sense of dysphoria,
mm-hmm,
that comes with not being able to keep up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Because yep, that thing this morning was a smorgasbord of crazy.
It was. It was. I mean, you know, and then some of the people on CNN were saying, well, maybe he mentioned that because he feels he's isolated and, you know, he feels that Putin, you know, Putin would talk to him at least at the conference, you know. Poor Donnie, you know, it's like he's such the victim. I mean, nobody likes him. It's not his fault. I just hope we can survive this man, you know. I mean, God forbid if he number one, if he gets reelected, and or number two, if there's not a democratic takeover of one or both you know, branches of the Congress, you know. And you know, I must say, I'm not too impressed by the Democrat showing in California in these contested congressional races. They finished behind the Republicans. I think the 8 seats they're targeting, I think they finished behind second to the Republicans in like 7 out of the 8 races. Even races in which the Republicans are retiring, like I think ISIS seat. I think the Republican, you know, had more votes than the Democrat. Now, I know part of that is that there were so many candidates on this jungle ballot, but I'll just talk to Sparky here for a second. I know that my understanding is that Nunez won like 58-32 against his main challenger.
I wasn't following that race.
Weren't you? No?
No. All I care is about my stupid congressman, Doug LaMalfa.
So what's he doing? What did he do?
Well, he's going to be running against, first time there's going to be a woman running in my district in forever,
mm-hmm,
for Congress.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had a woman a long time ago in the state government, but not federal. I mean, besides the two senators.
So how did the Democratic challenger do against LaMoffitt or whatever the guy's name is?
Well, she's a Justice Democrat that's been endorsed by the Young Turks and all that shit.
Okay.
And she seems like a pretty smart individual. She's got a degree in agricultural something from Chico State, I believe. And I voted for her, Aubrey Denny.
Okay.
She wasn't the established Democratic candidate, so I didn't,
okay,
just like I didn't vote for Feinstein.
Yeah. So how did she do in relationship to the incumbent? How far ahead was the incumbent of her?
Well, there was like 7 other people, but I mean, he got like 52% of the vote.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, that's
out of 111,000, but if,
okay. But
if you get these you know, March for Our Lives, change thing. People will, right, come through an area like this.
Yeah.
They're going to go on a 50-state tour, and if they get young people invigorated, who knows?
Well, you know, I've heard that combined, the Gen Xers and the millennials outnumber everybody else in the country now. So that if you could get them to vote, as a solid block, you know, that you could really change things. But I mean, we've been talking about the young vote ever since what was it? Was it the 21st Amendment that lowered the voting age to 18? And it really hasn't been that reliable, you know.
Shoot, I couldn't wait to vote when I turned 21.
Yeah, no, me too. I was 17 at the time of the 1980 caucuses, and but I was going to turn, 20. I was going to turn 18 before the election, and so I was able to, to caucus and then voted in the election. Although I'm trying to figure out how I could have done it, how I could have voted in the 1980 election if I wasn't. Okay. The election was in November. Yeah. Never mind. I was just a week past 18 when the elections were held in 1980. So, but like, you know, I guess, I just hope the Democrats can swing a few of those of these, you know, Southern California Republican seats, you know, to Democrats, because they really should be able to pick up like four or five House seats in a year where the, you know, president's a Republican, you know. Yeah, they really should with Trump, you know. It's like, if not, you know, I hear there's a, I think like 25%, there's a 25% gap in the number of people who say that, I think something like, I guess people by a margin of 25% say that, that it's necessary to have a check on Trump, you know, as far as, you know, voting for Congress people. You know, I'm just hoping that, I'm hoping that that materializes. I don't know.
Rick, Marty wants you to know. He says, tell Rick I'm ashamed of him. The 21st Amendment, that was the repeal of prohibition. The 26th Amendment lowered the voting age, unless I didn't hear
gosh,
him correctly.
Of course. There you go. I know. I math death. What can I say, Bob? You know, too many amendments.
Ciphering. Okay.
There you go. There you go. Yeah.
I was going to say that in Montana, we only have one representative here because of population. Our current representative came in when Zinke got into the Interior Department. I don't know if you heard about Gianforte punching out the.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he was. He's the one that's the incumbent here, and I voted for a lawyer, a consumer rights lawyer from Billings, but he got beat by a woman named Kathleen Williams. So I'm hoping that something miraculous happens, but I doubt it. But that's kind of the way it is here. So thank you.
No thanks necessary. Thank you.
You bet.
Yeah, glad you could join the group this week. I know you were having issues with your, I think, mic last week, weren't you? Or was it 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, I just have an iPad, and I just hadn't used it before. So.
Okay.
Yeah, but the nice thing about the iPad, as we learned from Larry there in Berkeley, is that it has a pretty fantastic microphone on it. And you've come through very clearly.
Well, that's good.
So okay. How's the fundraising coming, Bob?
Grim. Yeah. Darlene very kindly put a $100 challenge on the table at the beginning of the program. It was met to the tune of $25 of it was met. $75 remain. In fact, I just had a note come in from someone who contributes to the program but wishes to remain anonymous and said, please, listeners, Horn family community members, contribute your hard-earned money to support the Horn, please. And that I sincerely appreciate. That's a very, very kind sentiment. And as I've said, I mean, there are times that I hate talking about it. I prefer the issues. I prefer the cussing and conversing and the carrying on and even occasionally the serious stuff we do. But like I've said a million times before, it's the only way this stays on the air.
Bob, did you get my challenge of an hour and 20 minutes ago or so?
No, I did not. I didn't see that.
Oh, yeah. I said, hi, Bob. It's called a post-trial challenge. I said, hi, Bob. Just got back into town after finishing up my trial on Wednesday in SF. I'm going to offer the following challenge. I'll toss in 10 and we'll double it to 20 if met. Then I'll toss in another 30. And the 30 represents 25 from, I think, last week, which I didn't get around to putting on PayPal, plus a $5 penalty that I've imposed on myself, Bob.
You know,
is guaranteed.
For a tax lawyer, you're rough on yourself. That's not the first time you've imposed that penalty. Yeah. Well, thank you. So that means there's actually $110 worth of challenges on the table. Darlene just said, yeah, I'm feeling lonely over here with my unmet challenge. Come on, Horn family. Thank you, Darlene. Thank you. I hate it when people go out on a limb like that and it doesn't get responded to. I mean, it's just, you know, because the fact of the matter is that, you know, there are a lot more people who listen, and I understand times are tough and stuff, but you know, maybe one way to do that is just to sign up for a subscription this evening, and you're only out less than half the, you know, I keep hammering on it because I hate McDonald's hamburgers. You're only out less than half the cost of a McDonald's hamburger with no cheese per program. That's what you're giving up at a $10 subscription. And so, you know, if we had 9 people who did that this evening, boom. That would take care of the challenges, both of them. And then we'd only have $230 to go to finish the week. So that's what, I mean, we can't, because, you know, overall, Rick, we came into the evening at minus 440.
Oh, that's, you know, not good.
I'm sure that's a number that's near and dear to Sparky's heart, 440.
It's within $20 of a number that's near and dear to him anyway.
Yeah, what, 460?
420.
Well, no, I was thinking more like voltage.
Oh, okay.
I was more into 277, 480, Bob.
Oh, okay. Well,
do you want me to explain that?
No, it'll just make my poor little head hurt.
Never mind.
Okay. I mean, I don't have anything to take the sting out, like lemon ice or whatever. By the way, the lemon stuff and the blue, based on responses of the Horn Family Community Congregation, the lemon stuff and the blue hooses are definitely big popular among the community.
Lemon haze.
Okay.
And blue dream.
Blue dream. Thank you, Clarity. Hey, what was that? I saw one of you. You know, you tweet, and I see your tweets, and I try to like as many of them as I catch. I saw one that you posted some picture of, like, the internal structure of skin, and you said you were on fire from the inside out or something. What's going on?
Oh, that was a haiku that I was doing my electrolysis, and as my practitioner said, we're getting into what she called a tricky part. So that's the first line, is tricky area. And then the second line is removing the brush today. I almost put removing the bush today, but, you know, that'd be overstating it. And then it would brush bush is still a colloquialism. And the last night I'm screaming inside because I try not to squirm or scream or anything. And I was reminded of you talking about chomping into that Scotch bonnet. And it was funny because it was probably some of the most intense pain I've had since I started doing it. And about 5 minutes later, I went, oh, I must have gotten an endorphin rush. You know, it was just like, I just felt totally transformed. And the pain was somewhere else. So, yeah, that's what that was about.
Okay.
I think I punched in electrolysis, and that's what came up in the GIF feed. But it was pretty obscure.
Okay, well, those moments of curiosity just come along, and you don't want to just say on Twitter. I figured we might have a chance to chat, and I would just ask.
But I guess I do have something to share with the community. Wednesday was 9 months until I have my surgery. I have a surgical date now, March 6th of 2019. So
yeah. You started a countdown?
No, I'm going to wait till 90 days before because it's, which will, you know, start a little before Christmas and go from there. But yeah, it's real now. It's not hypothetical. And so they put me on towards the top of the scheduling for intensive electrolysis. I'll be going once a week starting in August. So, but luckily I have two medical drivers that are very friendly, and you know, we get along great and we can talk about stuff. Except for that one Republican woman that insisted talk radio, it's been, you know, a fairly good experience with all the drivers are, you know, nice people. One guy, it's very interesting. He's a very conservative guy, but he's, you know, doesn't come across as being judgmental. What you might call in a quote unquote good Christian. But then again, his wife runs the, what do they call it? The pregnancy center, you know, trying to talk girls into not getting an abortion.
Oh yeah. Those frauds, the so-called crisis pregnancy. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So I don't know. I guess all in all, you know, they mean well, but I don't think this, you know, as you do, the state has any business into women's business, you know. Well, they talk about Roe, and I don't know if I brought it up before, but I heard somebody talking on KPFA about the Roe decision and that the one that they should call up is Shemp v. McVeigh, I think it is. And it's about a guy that had this disease and he needed a blood transplant, a blood transfusion from a rare type of blood. And he found out that his cousin or something had that type. And the cousin said, I'm not going to, you know, he was a Jehovah's Witness or something, and he said, I'm not going to give any blood up, you know. And the guy ended up dying, you know, and they took it to court, and they said, no, you can't compel somebody to donate a body part or an organ or anything else, even if it will save the life of the person that's the recipient of that donation. And that, I don't know, it's a right of privacy, it's a right of, you know, all these things kind of...
Bodily integrity.
Yeah, exactly, which Roe did, you know, it was decided on an economic, that it was, you know, people that were you know, well-to-do could go right across the border and get an abortion, or fly to Switzerland and get an abortion. And Miss Rowe, you know, she couldn't. I think that was, you know, that's what I got out of it. So, you know, I think that Roe was still definitely in danger, you know, and I don't know.
And not to be dismissive, Clarity, yeah, Roe's in danger. Everything is in danger. Civil society is in danger. Constitutional governance is in danger. And while what happened this morning just looked like an exercise in al fresco madness, it was another exhibit in the level of danger that we face.
Well, I was watching his eyes, you know, as he cocked his head back and forth. And, you know, you can just... you can tell he's just kind of doing a little bit of free-forming, and he doesn't really care what comes out. He knows he's got, you know, he's going to fling out these words that make, you know, his base think, well, he's being Trumpy. He's, you know.
Yeah, he's just he's just a word sewer.
Yeah.
Not a word sower, a word sewer.
Yeah. But you quoted 25% in, you know, depression rates have increased. And I read that since 99, which is almost 20 years, it's increased 30%. And what somebody said is, if you're not depressed, you're not paying attention, you know, or if you're not enraged, you're not paying attention. But I'm sensing, you know, we've talked about this how many times about needing a break and just being burnt out because of you know, the 24-hour news cycle, and every day he throws out another, you know, fucking shrapnel bomb to, you know.
Right, and there's, and you know, there's one other thing that's out there that bears mentioning. When the story broke, because this is significant, and Billable Rick, you might have some expertise on this too. When the news broke that Mueller and his team had gotten access to some people's cell phones. Sean Hannity jumped out and said, if you're even tangentially related to this investigation, smash your cell phone into tiny bits. His presence or his status as a blithering idiot on Fox does not confer immunity from obstruction of, because that's witness tampering, isn't it? Just because you do it in front of a camera with a microphone attached to you, that doesn't mean it's not witness tampering.
And please,
well, it's,
digital information.
I would regard it more as like obstruction, because he's advising, you know, people who might be targets of the Mueller investigation to basically, you know, destroy all their phones, you know. So it's not really, he's not suggesting what the witness is. Maybe it's both. Maybe it's you know, witness tampering and obstruction.
Yeah, I'm looking for a multi-count indictment, because that's the other thing. Since we do try to do some current events and news of the day, Paul Manafort got charged with more shit today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just seems like Mueller's tightening the screws. But as a prosecutor, does Mueller not have an ethical obligation? I mean, he can't just drip as a means of applying more pressure, can he? He has an affirmative duty to bring the charges of which he is aware. So what's the nature of the argument? We just became aware?
I think so, yeah. I think so.
We're charging as promptly as we may?
Yeah. Yeah, now that has to do with the witness tampering, does it not? The obstruction. I haven't been able to read the indictment. I heard about it. You know, I wasn't able to read about it in any detail.
Yeah, he's not supposed to contact witnesses.
Yeah, yeah.
And he sent direct messages and emails to witnesses who he knew Yeah.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, Larry.
Hey, Larry.
How are you? Yeah, I mean, I think Manafort's in huge trouble. And I think he's counting on a Trump pardon, to tell you the truth. You know?
Okay, now, we may have been over this ground. And by the way, we've made up a little ground. We are... we're $55 away. We're $55 away from meeting Darlene's challenge, so please don't leave Darlene flapping in the wind out there. I just mentioned that because we're running out of time. But we may have touched on this, but and we know there can be preemptive pardons because of Richard Nixon.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But can Trump just stop everything against Manafort tomorrow if he wants to? I mean, does the pardon power include the ability to interfere, because that's the right word, to interfere with an ongoing current prosecution?
There's no restriction on it. Now, if we had a Congress that was anything other than a lapdog of the president, president would never be able to get away with that. But we have a total breakdown of, Congress and its, role in this country, in the politics of this country. It just is not doing its job. That's why you have a group of Democratic senators trying to sue the Trump administration or Trump for violating the emoluments clause in district court in the District of Columbia. And they're having some difficulties persuading the judge that they in fact have legal standing to make that claim, you know?
And and along it, just to make sure that we get a couple of the, the other thing, let's put it that way. The other thing, I saw a photograph today and it accompanied a Facebook post.
Okay.
You know, they called the police on, Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley the other day when he tried to get into one of our, kiddie concentration camps.
Mm-hmm.
And that was shocking enough. Well, he finally got in.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not allowed to take pictures. Oh, no. But apparently, at least one photograph got out. And it confirmed what he had previously said. Apparently, this facility is an abandoned Walmart.
Mm-hmm. I heard that, yeah.
Remember when the abandoned Walmarts were going to be the secret access points to the huge network of Jade Helm tunnels?
Well, they were, Bob. That's exactly what happened. They've just repurposed the Jade Helm tunnels now, Bob.
Well, it turns out that, they've got a new purpose now, because there is a photo of Jeff Merkley being walked through this facility, and it includes children.
Mm.
Children.
Mm-hmm.
Little children in cages.
Jeez. Ugh.
That's America. That is America. Yeah. On the 8th day of June 2018, we keep children in cages. And you know, for all of our much vaunted pontificating about the moral fiber and the exceptional nature of America, that photograph is our damnation. Plain and simple. A country that puts children in dog cages is not among the civilized company of nations.
No.
No, it's not. Certainly not. Mm-mm. No.
And it was accompanied by, the photo was accompanied by text. Senator Merkley was finally provided a tour of the facility here in town that houses once accompanied children who have been separated from their parents or guardian by ICE. keeping children in cages when they are not criminals, making them sleep on concrete floors for months at a time without due process because 45 has reduced legal funding resources for these children, causing gridlock in the courts, which requires they remain longer in these private yet paid for by tax dollars facilities. This is done merely as a punishment. Is this who we are now as a nation? Well, that's a rhetorical question, but it's a rhetorical question with an affirmative answer. Yes, it is. Previously, the children would remain with their parent until they were to appear in court. 45 and Sessions flipped the process, so now they end up incarcerated in the beginning as a means of punishment. Since Senator Merkley could not take pictures, this is similar to the scene that Senator, or actually it's Representative Jim McGovern, saw in another facility. This is the oral statement from Senator Merkley via The Nation. The makeup of that processing center is shocking when you see it, but let me go to the heart of the issue. The issue is this new policy of when families are seeking asylum, their children are torn away from them and sent who knows where. The parents are beside themselves not knowing what happened to their kids, and they never know if they'll see them again. This is a version of trauma. Families seeking asylum have by definition experienced trauma abroad and perhaps trauma en route. So finally they get to the border and they think finally we're safe. But instead they're put into this prison-like facility. I wouldn't say like. I'd say concentration camp. And separated. And put through this new ordeal. I'll tell you what was very difficult to see. One room had smaller cyclone fences. They look like the way you construct a dog kennel. They're larger, but that's the thought that comes to mind when you see them. Then they have these space blankets, light foil blankets, which is a very strange sight to see kids using a space blanket as a cushion, but they don't provide any cushion or as a cover for privacy. There's no mattresses in that section. After they go through interviews, they go into a big warehouse. I called them cages, and the White House said that's unfair. They aren't cages. We'll call it a cell, then. It's a cyclone fence-constructed area. There were all these boys in this big enclosure, maybe 3 to 4 dozen boys, and they lined up from smallest to largest to get ready to go eat. The tiniest kid at the front of the line, he was knee-high to a grasshopper. He was 4, maybe 5 years old. They go up in age to 16 or 17, and they're kept all together. And this is a crime against humanity, and Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump should at this very moment be apprehended and sent immediately to The Hague to stand trial.
Amen. May I say amen? Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Well, unfortunately, unfortunately, it wasn't that long ago that we were talking about how another U.S. president should have been, and actually the acting president, we'll call him, should have been sent to the Hague for attacking another country without provocation. And they still roam free, as far as I know, right? And in fact, one of them is looking good based on the, the cult 45 leader right now, you know?
Let's not forget he kidnapped Bertrand Aristide and shipped him over to Uganda.
That you're talking about? Are you talking about
Bush?
Was that Bush? Was that Obama? That was Bush, I guess. Yeah, that was. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, didn't want Haiti to go that way.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, we've lost our bearings ever since 9/11, 2001. We just have not. We've not recovered as a democracy since then. I mean, to the extent we even were ever a democracy, you know?
You said that. You've got that right, Rick.
Yeah.
Well, you all know what I think of all these folks. Anyway, Bob, I got to tell you, I felt the least interested in, as I mentioned last week, in voting this time around, and the least motivated, but I did vote, and I don't know, Dunk. I guess we got what was expected, but it's and Rick, we really need to get rid of this government, and really need to get rid of this Congress. And I don't know how we're going to do it, given the particular legal and political constraints that we live under, but this is intolerable. Bob, I'm glad that you were able to read that Facebook post or able to read that comment. Mercedes was saying that she knows about this for some time, that this kind of behavior from the government has gone on. Okay, I'm going to let you go then. It's 6 o'clock.
Well, finish your thought. Finish your thought, Larry.
Well, you know, I just feel that that it's very difficult for me to get motivated, given the kind of political institutions and economic and social institutions that we live under at this point in time, with the kind of people that are in power, to feel that there's any real hope to do anything that's going to make anything any better. And The Nation magazine and Yes magazine had some articles about the housing crisis now that's going on. There's a big housing crisis, but yet in my city, in Berkeley, they're building new apartment buildings, for market rate apartment buildings all over the city now.
Luxury apartment buildings as well, right? They're luxury.
You know, new for market, they're not subject to any kind of rent control or any kind of vacancy, you know, control or any kind of rent ceilings whatsoever. And apparently the homeless population, which I have always seen here in Berkeley, I've always seen homeless people here in Berkeley, apparently now the rest of the country is getting a taste of what, you know, I'm always frustrated, Bob, but it doesn't appear to be getting much better, and something eventually have to come to grips with the fact that we have to change our social and political institutions if we want to have anything close to a democracy. And that's an opinion, folks. That's not a fact. That's just my my humble opinion. So I don't know if you can, anybody wants to add anything to that? That's fine with me. It just is.
Well, I think, you know, I think, Larry, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. Just look at the so-called Tax Cuts and Jobs Act bill that just passed at the end of last year. And I mean, that's like a huge giveaway to the rich. It's not going to help average people. In fact, I don't think, you know, I think most people have said that it's actually hurt them. I mean, all the goodies are going to the well off, you know, and that's what happens when you have a Republican president, unfortunately, you know.
Well, what I have to say is, it's not that we don't. Bob, are you still there?
I'm listening.
Yeah, what I have to say about this is, this country has enough money. It has enough wealth. It can do more for people and provide jobs for people. And we have a friend of this chat group that just lost his job. And the reality is we have the resources to be able to provide or repurpose our, you know, our manufacturing base, and be able to provide ways for people to be able to at least eat and have housing and perhaps have a little bit of leisure and, you know, a little bit of spending money so they can have something of an enjoyable life. And this government and these people in Congress, statewide and also federal, don't seem to give a good goddamn, you know, about that. And if they're not going to do anything about it, then I'm a disabled person and I'm vulnerable, so I can't go out there by myself and do anything about it by myself. I would feel powerless if I were part of a small minority group who would be out here complaining. But we need to get a large group of people out here organized to fight back. That's all.
Never give up your vote, Larry.
Yeah.
And let's be clear.
I know. I've been voting since 1972, so I'm just telling.
Well, the people I
never give up your vote.
Yeah, we have a state assembly person here that bought her way into the office, and I don't know who she is, but she's probably going to be our state assembly person. And Tony Thurmond gave up his seat to run for school superintendent, as you know, Rick and Dunk. But I wish he'd stayed in office, because I know who he is, and I knew who some of the other people who were running for that seat. But this person who managed to get 30% of the vote, over 15%, I don't know who she is. See
well,
what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, the thing with the jungle primary is that's about all you need to get to the final two. If you have, like, you know, 10, you know, even Dana Rohrabacher, you know, down in Orange County representative in the House, he got 30% of the vote, but he's been in the House like 30 years and he only got like 30%. And so he's going to face a Democrat. All you need is a sizable, you know, minority vote or chunk of, you know, basically, you know, 30% is all you need. You don't need a huge, you know, you don't need the 50% if you have that many people in a primary.
Well, Feinstein, surprisingly enough, won by a very big margin, which really freaked me out. It really did. But I appreciate, Bob, that you gave me the opportunity to finally say something coherent that made sense for the first time in probably a year and a half.
Oh, you've made a lot more sense than you know you've made, apparently, Larry. Don't sell yourself short. No, don't.
Okay.
Absolutely
but
not.
But I appreciate getting a couple minutes to rant there, and that I was able to say something that was coherent and hung together. I appreciate you, and I appreciate everyone for allowing me to do that. Thank you.
You're more than welcome, Larry.
Game time. I'm out of here.
All right.
You
well,
betcha, Larry.
I'm gonna
okay,
roll on
you.
For. I'm gonna roll for just a couple of more minutes here. I'm proud to announce that via an anonymous contributor, both Billable Rick's San Francisco trial challenge and Darlene's challenge have been met. Hallelujah. And
awesome.
Thank you also to Sharon. Thank you very, very kindly. So those are met. And that leaves us with $200 to finish the week. And maybe that'll happen overnight, or if not, we'll talk about it on Moran Monday. We started the program talking about the death of Tony Bourdain, and in this era right now, it feels a little like maybe what the death of Hemingway must have felt like to people back in 1960. And how odd that they were both 61 when they decided to check out. And earlier, I mentioned some scumbag on Twitter who had been burnt to the ground by Bourdain earlier, who decided to take out his vengeance on a dead man. And I said that was about as nasty and sleazy as it can get. But as if we needed any reminder, we're going to finish with some audio, and maybe, it may be deemed unnecessary, but I think it is necessary to point out how awful the right wing genuinely is. And the fact that they have no amount, not a shred of common decency. The people who listen to what you're about, who intentionally listen to what you're about to hear, are largely comprise Trump's hardcore, dead end, cancerous knot of losers and hard cases. The neo-Nazi base of Donald Trump listens to this filth. So merely by way of putting evidence into the zeitgeist, if you will, of how vile and how vulgar these people are, well, we've got this.
We've got news coming from Alex Jones right now. Let's go out to Alex on the phone lines. Alex Jones, what is breaking?
All right, I'm going to take over right here, and I'm going to try to be as calm as I can, as I've got four pages of notes. So I'm here, ladies and gentlemen, covering undoubtedly some of the most dangerous information I've ever covered on air. There's a reason they want to shut down InfoWars, and it's because they know that we're able to put out countervailing narratives to what they officially said. Anthony Bourdain, Tony Bourdain, is one of the most popular TV hosts in the world. He's the only successful thing on CNN. He dominated Netflix. He has a little 9-year-old daughter. He just got remarried. And then he dies in a crappy hotel room in Paris.
Now, see, there's a reason we're deconstructing this. This sleazy, filthy shitbag, Alex Jones, tells his audience of mouth-walking knuckle breathers that he has the inside skinny, that he knows things. And he can't even bother, and it's there, it's publicly consumable. He can't, I know, I got it, I got inside knowledge. Monkeys with jellyfish monkey hybrids from Hong Kong. But he can't even get the age of his daughter, Bourdain's daughter, right. And he doesn't even know where he was found dead. Some sleazy hotel in Paris. Some crappy hotel room in Paris. Well, one, Bourdain didn't stay in crappy hotel rooms. Unless he could help it. And two, he wasn't in fucking Paris. He was in Strasbourg, which is sincerely, unmistakably not Paris. So even though he claims secret inside knowledge, he can't even get the public facts straight. But he's got a paranoid agenda to advance. Instead of the nuanced discussion that we had at the beginning of this program, no. The little weirdos that cling to him and hang on every word that dribbles and vomits out of the mouth of Dolt 45, they prefer this sensationally asinine, insane garbage.
And CNN's Brian Stelter is the first to tell us that he died of suicide hanging himself. Now, I knew he'd been critical of Hillary. Said that, that she shouldn't have basically defended Weinstein. Said it was shameful. I knew he joked about feeding Trump hemlock. And I thought, you know, a lot of these rich, powerful Hollywood folks commit suicide. Maybe he did commit suicide. But I said the fact that he had a lot of powerful enemies, it should at least be investigated. I said that in a tweet. I got a call from my source, who is even willing for me to now say who he is, but he was very emotional, and he'd already let me in on this a few months ago, and he's actually even already talked about this on air, but I'm just not going to do that at this point.
Why, Alex? Because he only exists in your mind? Like the fake PR guy that Donald Trump used to pretend to be to call up newspapers in New York and talk about how awesome he was in bed?
I'm going to shoot an HD report as soon as I'm done here. And I'm going to then reach out to some other people. But here's the bottom line. I was told several months ago that a bunch of other big...
Oh, and by the way, as Darlene points out, no, he was not recently remarried either. He's not remarried at all. And so you can understand the setting here. They've got some little neo-maxi Zoom dweeby sitting behind a desk at InfoWars Central, and Alex is on the phone as if he's, you know, in a bunker somewhere hiding from the fucking Illuminati. Sorry about all the dirty words late in the program, but Jesus Christ.
People are going to start going public. And then, of course, you saw Kanye. And then a few weeks ago, we said that even more big cultural icons, some of the biggest ones in media, some of the biggest people in culture, were going to be going public. And so this morning when I woke up and I had seen that Tony Bourdain had committed suicide, supposedly, I went, what is it about that? What was it in the news? What? So I was sitting there search engineering for like an hour. Well, what was it? Why was I talking about Bourdain? And then all of a sudden, the producer calls me about an hour ago and said, right after I got off air with you guys, and said, you have got to call this source. He's really upset right now. And I went, oh, my gosh. He's talked about it on air. Ladies and gentlemen, Bourdain.
Yeah, by the way, Alex Jones's stupid tweet says, and now we learn he supposedly hung himself. No, asshole, he hanged himself. Jesus Christ. Hung has a different meaning, stupid.
Was a powerful cultural figure. And Bourdain had learned about the big awakening that was happening. And he had met with Elon Musk, who he's already very good friends with, in Morocco, in Marrakesh, at a big solar farm, experimental farm. And I'll just leave it at that. And they had taped an 11.5-minute episode of the upcoming TV series that he was wrapping up in Paris. This is 2 months ago. Nobody knows this, and I'm laying these facts out so people understand.
Yeah, nobody knows this because it's not real. But you people, hey, how about some paleo chocolate chicken bone drink? It'll eat your brain from the it melts in your brain, not in your mouth. I can't. This goes on like this for, he was going to do a Kanye and the Illuminati, Bohemian Grover, aliens from Norblap 9. We're going to rub him out. I found out about this from Sister Carol Baker, who noted along the way, I hope Bourdain's family sues the skin off of Alex Jones. And I do, too. I do, too. Jesus. But I felt like that needed sharing. Just to remind you that even in moments when other people are trying to be decent. Jesus, even Dolt 45 said, I enjoyed his show. You get this. So, you know, that's how it goes. Hey, Larry and Billable Rick, any thoughts? Erwin, well, any thoughts?
Well, Bob, my question is because of these kinds of the media, the mainstream media is allowed to get away with. We ought to have, they ought to have the fairness doc. They ought to have the fairness doctrine, number one, and number two. You know, I know that this guy is a sleazebag, and I don't know why we have to dignify what these people are doing when they're so shitty. I mean, I'm talking about, the Alex Jones types and what have you. I don't listen to them because I don't get anything from them, and I don't get titillated or excited about the fact that they're on there. So I don't know why we have to. I mean, the less that I have to hear that, the better off I am psychologically and emotionally.
Well, I understand, but I believe that from where I stand, Larry, we have a duty to point out this odious behavior, because you can't always just ignore them and they'll go away, because they clearly haven't gone away.
I think I agree too.
I don't listen to them, but I do like to hear other people talk about them because it's something that's happening, and I'm dealing with this kind of stuff in my own family, so and on Facebook and everywhere else, so I need to at least know what's being said on the other side. So
that's my
opinion.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, Irwin. I mean, I don't like to listen to the guy, but I think he's dangerous enough that you have to be aware of some of the, you know, bullshit that he's...
And you have to be able to refute it when crazy old Uncle Fox at the end of the bar starts shrieking about it.
Right, exactly. I mean...
Because arguments unanswered are arguments admitted. You know that, Rick.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So he's saying that who exactly killed Bourdain? Hillary? Or what
no,
the hell?
They.
They, okay. Who is they? I mean, that's, you know, the Illuminati?
It's the Illuminati, the Bohemian Grove, Rothschild, Learned Elders of Zion.
Yeah.
Aliens
yeah.
from Norblap 9.
Yeah. So, I mean,
monkeys with jellyfish brain hybrids.
Yeah, I mean, the guy's brain is pickled, I think, Bob. I mean, you know.
No, there's nothing wrong with his brain. He's working a hustle, and he's working it to perfection. The only problem is there's no James Randi out there to bust him the way James Randi busted Peter Popoff and Uri Geller. Because he's figured out the racket. But anyway, I got to get out of here for the evening, but I did want to share that along the way. Thanks, and I'm awfully glad you got in, Irwin. I hope you'll be here again. Don't be a stranger. Thank you, Billable Rick, for your challenge. Thank you to Darlene for her challenge. Thank you to everybody who responded to the challenge, anonymously and non. And more Ann Monday will be here before we know it. We'll probably have them stacked up like cordwood, because God almighty, he's often... Could our friends in Fair Canada, could you get the Canoodly and Mounted Police to arrest him, please, and send him to The Hague? That'd be awfully nice. just a favor. Just ask him. Everybody have a wonderful evening, and we will talk soon. Thanks again to everybody who keeps the program on the air. As I said at the beginning, I say at the end, thanks to each and every one of you who share your precious finite time engaged in this long-running little conversation. Thank you so much. It is an honor and a privilege and a pleasure to be in your company and in your friendship. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to, Sparky and Asa and Steve from Georgia Stan, moderators in the chat room this evening. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, HeadOn.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Have a great weekend, everybody. Later.